30 years ago, the Berlin Wall came down. Crowds stormed the wall that divided East and West Germany, and within a year, the two countries reunited. Coming up, we look back and explore the new dividing lines that exist today. It's Friday, November 8th, and this is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead this hour, Democratic presidential candidate Buttigieg says he knows that a top concern for many voters is civility, especially at the presidential level.
So much depends on how the president acts and how the president talks. It's not just about running the government. It's about setting a tone.
We'll speak with the candidate. And are boys really more adept at doing math than girls? A new study of 10-year-olds says nope. It's 4:01. News headlines and the forecast are coming up next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. In testimony to the impeachment inquiry, two White House aides offer new details about the Trump administration's effort to get Ukraine to open investigations they saw as politically motivated. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on one meeting they described.
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who's on Trump's National Security Council, says he had a visceral reaction when he heard a U.S. ambassador tell Ukrainians they had to open an investigation into the Bidens to get a White House visit. Then National Security Advisor John Bolton cut short the meeting, as a former official, Fiona Hill, also recounts in her testimony. She says Bolton told her he was not going to be part of any, quote, drug deal. Hill says Bolton also encouraged his staff to keep their distance from Trump's private lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, calling him a hand grenade that's going to blow everyone up. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Russia's criticizing the administration for abandoning arms control agreements that have been the bedrock of international security for decades. NPR's Lucian Kim reports from Moscow just a single treaty now limits the nuclear arsenals of the U.S. and Russia.
Speaking at an arms control conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned of an unprecedented deterioration of global security. Lavrov said the crisis has been caused by Washington's disinterest in arms control as the U.S. seeks global military dominance. Earlier this year, the Trump administration withdrew from a 1987 treaty banning intermediate-range missiles after accusing Russia of violating the terms. The only major arms control agreement left was negotiated by the Obama administration. Lavrov said the U.S. has been avoiding talks on extending that treaty when it expires in a little more than a year. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
In Brazil, former President Lula da Silva is now out of prison after a judge ordered him released. NPR's Philip Reeves has more.
Da Silva, a two-term president who's universally known as Lula, was jailed 19 months ago on corruption-related charges. His supporters believe he was the victim of a plot to stop him securing a third term in last year's elections, which were won by Jair Bolsonaro from the far right. Lula faces other corruption allegations, but these won't deter his supporters in Brazil and throughout Latin America from celebrating the return to the landscape of one of the left's major figures.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves reporting. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is reporting a breakthrough in its investigation into vaping-related lung illnesses. The CDC says it has detected vitamin E acetate in lung tissue samples from patients who were hospitalized after vaping. They say while vitamin E is safe to apply on skin or swallow, it can be dangerous if it's inhaled. Vitamin E is suspected of being used to dilute THC in vape cartridges. This week, the CDC announced that more than 2,000 people in more than half the country have gotten sick, and of these, 39 people have died. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Investigators believe a chemical reaction led to the death of a restaurant general manager in Burlington yesterday. Fire officials say the reaction started when two cleaning products came in contact with each other inside the Buffalo Wild Wings last night. Investigators say the general manager was trying to squeegee the cleaning materials out of the building when he was overcome by the fumes. A federal appeals court judge today dismissed the request from lawyers for Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev to unseal part of a document that they say would help them prove Tsarnaev was under the control of his older brother when the two carried out the terrorist attack at the marathon. Attorneys wanted to unseal parts of a search warrant for a vehicle owned by Tsarnaev's deceased brother as they appeal his death sentence. The defense says the warrant was to allow investigators to look for evidence to link Tamerlan Tsarnaev to a triple murder in Waltham. Amtrak is reporting record ridership growth on the Northeast Corridor. That growth was part of a record year for ridership nationwide for the fiscal year that ended in September. WBUR's Ninjor Enwemeka reports.
There are almost 9 million trips on the Northeast Regional train, about a 3% increase from the previous year. And Acela trips were also up, with over 3.5 million rides in fiscal year 2019. Amtrak president and CEO Richard Anderson says the company plans to expand service along the East Coast.
The long-term plan will be to run nonstop Acelas both ways in the peaks, in the morning and the evenings, between New York and Washington, Boston and New York.
Amtrak also reported a nearly $30 million operating loss, an improvement from previous years. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Zininjor Enwemeka.
The Census Bureau plans to raise wages for census workers in parts of central and western Mass. It's part of an effort to boost lagging recruitment, especially in rural areas. The temporary workers are needed to survey households next year for the population count. The Bureau says it will raise pay by up to $1.50 per hour in Worcester, Hampton, Franklin, Hampshire and Berkshire counties. Boston Bruins are out in Detroit tonight to take on the Red Wings, and in the forecast, a few stray showers out there right now, especially inland, some snow showers. Tonight, that is clear and cold. Temperatures down in the upper teens to low 20s. Tomorrow, only near 40 degrees with sunshine. Sunday and Monday, partly sunny, highs in the low 50s. 33 degrees now in Boston at 6 past 4.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Always Health Partners, a different kind of health plan with benefits and programs that put you first. Learn more at alwayshealthpartners.org, a member of Partners Healthcare. And Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth, Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. This week has seen hundreds of pages of transcripts released in the ongoing impeachment inquiry into President Trump. And today, you can add 806 new pages to that total. They spell out the testimonies of former White House Russia advisor Fiona Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council. And these pages show how the ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, acted to press the Ukrainian government to open investigations into the Bidens. And they show that Sondland said that there would be no meeting between the White House and Ukraine until that happened. NPR reporter Tim Mak has been following all of this, and he joins us now. Hey, Tim.
Hey there.
All right, so let's start with Fiona Hill. She's the former Russia policy expert on the National Security Council. What did she tell House investigators?
So Hill tells a story about a meeting between Ukrainian officials and White House officials in D.C. prior to that now famous July 25th phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. At the time, Ukrainian officials are trying to arrange a meeting between President Zelensky and President Trump. Now, National Security Advisor John Bolton is pushing that off, won't agree, wants to discuss further the possibility of a meeting, but Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland blurts out that there's already a deal between the White House Chief of Staff and him, and says that they will have a meeting with the president if the Ukrainian government launches investigations into their energy sector. So this shows how Gordon Sondland was running an unofficial rogue diplomatic channel with the White House Chief of Staff's seeming consent.
Okay, let's turn now to the testimony from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He's the current director for European Affairs at the National Security Council. What did we learn from his transcript?
Well, Vindman is an active duty military officer. He's a professional. He knows how this process, these conversations between world leaders, normally go. And something struck him about this July 25th phone call between the president and the president of Ukraine. He was on the call, and afterwards, he couldn't make the edits to the rough transcript that are kind of part of his job, and it really suggested to him how sensitive this issue was to people in the White House. Vindman also felt that something wrong had occurred on the call, and it speaks to the heart of whether there was an effort to press Ukrainians for an investigation. So here I am reading from the transcript. Congressman Peter Welch says, "And was there any doubt in your mind as to what the president, our president, was asking for as a deliverable?" And Vindman replies, "There was no doubt." Later, Vindman is pressed by Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe, who asked how we know that there was a demand by the president, since the rough transcript of the call doesn't include that word. Vindman explains that there are power disparities between these two presidents, and that those power disparities are so vast that it was quite obvious it was a demand, that in order to get a White House meeting, the Ukrainians had to start up investigations.
Okay, so further buttressing the Democrats' case that there was a quid pro quo. Also within these pages and pages, I understand that we saw references about acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. How did Hill and Vindman describe Mulvaney's role in all of this?
Well, Fiona Hill testified about how John Bolton was disturbed about the pressing of the Ukrainian officials for investigations and Mulvaney's apparent role in it. Vindman also says that Mulvaney's office was behind the hold in military aid. He says that he was told in July that the hold on military aid was coming from the White House Chief of Staff's office.
Okay, so speaking of Mick Mulvaney, he was subpoenaed but did not show up, correct?
Right. He was supposed to show up today, and he didn't, but we have heard from him. You'll recall the press conference he gave where he essentially said, look, there was a quid pro quo. This is the way the game is played. Get over it. But later he reversed himself and tried to walk it back. These transcripts show he had a central role in this whole saga, that he was involved in both the withholding of the aid and the conditions conveyed to the Ukrainians in order for them to achieve their goal of a meeting with President Trump.
That's NPR's Tim Mak. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Time now to talk about the week in politics. Today I'm joined by Margaret Hoover of PBS's Firing Line. Hi there, Margaret.
Hi.
Hi. And E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Georgetown's McCourt School. E.J., welcome back.
Great to be with you.
All right. Top line reaction from each of you to all those transcripts we have just been hearing about from Tim Mak, the hundreds and hundreds of pages that seem to emerge every day. Any of them a game changer? What's the takeaway? E.J., you first.
I think it's moving the game in the direction it was already moving, which is more and more and more evidence that there was a quid pro quo. I was also, by the way, struck, and I should say Fiona Hill was my colleague at the Brookings Institution. I was also struck by her discussion of the threat she felt she was under and others were. And she also talked about the very damaging role played by some of this misinformation in our efforts to fight future Russian interference in the election. I think the Republicans are now going to be reduced to trying to throw Mick Mulvaney, Rudy Giuliani, and many others under the bus. They seem to be trying to create some ignorance defense of President Trump, that this all went on and he had nothing to do with it. They've still got to deal with that White House document in which he asked for a favor. So I think they are just being pushed back and back in their defense. I think they're finally going to say, okay, he did it, but we shouldn't impeach him. That's where this seems to be going.
All right. So your take would be this has been a very good week for Democrats. Margaret, what do you think?
This week has been a good week for getting to the truth. The release of the transcripts has been enormously detailed, and it says three things just top line. One, there is no doubt that there was a quid pro quo. That the doubt or the question about whether that existed has been effectively erased because
even
of the
Gordon
of these
Sondland has said, "I now remember. My memory's been refreshed. Not only was there a quid pro quo, but I delivered it."
The other two things that are important to remember is that what we have seen is little leaks, dribs and drabs of the public hearing what was happening in these hearings. But now, with the transcripts of these testimonies, what you have are two things additionally: the veracity of the information we were getting through leaks is verified and more. There's an enormous amount of texture in the transcripts that verifies that the information was true and that the character of the individuals who are testifying is unflawed. From Fiona Hill to Alex Vindman to Kent, you have a propensity of data. You have an enormous amount of data now and testimony under oath that demonstrates that these people are people of upstanding character and true civil servants who are not adhering to any political agenda. They are simply serving their country.
And could I underscore just one? That's a really important point, and I think that will be very telling when these hearings go public, because I think people have a good sense of that when they watch someone like Fiona Hill or like Vindman or who really, as Margaret said, are really civil servants.
Now, about public opinion, though, I will say this. I don't believe that any of the information is going to dramatically sway that has been released over the weekend. I don't think Americans are going to go home and read 1,300 pages of transcripts, but it will play into what we see next week, because the theater and the performance and what Americans see next week on television as these public testimonies begin is when you're really going to begin to see what we, those of us who are reading the transcripts, see right now.
A whole three-ring circus unfolding on Capitol Hill next week. Meanwhile, the rest of the world keeps spinning, and among the things spinning, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, now says he might be jumping back into the Democratic field. He says he doesn't see anybody who can beat Trump right now, so he's weighing this again. Reaction from each of you, good idea, bad idea? Margaret.
Well, if you believe that the country's politics have become so polarized, there is a hyper-partisanship that it pervades the processes of nominating a candidate, and you represent or you believe that a candidate who represents either the center-left or the center-right is going to represent the majority of Americans, you should be happy that Mike Bloomberg is considering running. Mike Bloomberg is a moderate Democrat. He's not a progressive Democrat in the mold of Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, and he knows that. And he's concerned that there is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party the Democratic Party is going to lose. His side's going to lose. And what's very interesting is he's always been a data guy. The data has not changed. The data does not favor Mike Bloomberg winning a progressive primary. But he seems to be moving the direction of getting in anyway, which is a curious turn of events.
It certainly shakes things up. EJ, is there even a path to the nomination for somebody jumping in so late?
I don't see a path for him. Let's just say first, Mike Bloomberg was a good mayor in New York City. He's a moderate who in many, many ways was a progressive mayor. And no one
used to be a moderate Republican. I mean,
right.
He
was very.
The path.
He took the Republican line on the ballot so he could become mayor. He's never really been a Republican, but he was one nominally. And no one, by the way, has done more to finance the gun control movement. He's made a huge difference that way. But it is very hard to see how he wins. He has really made Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders very happy because they have a billionaire foil now that they can play against. And he seems to be giving a vote of no confidence in Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, the people closest to him. Biden has certainly disappointed some of his backers. Buttigieg is actually gaining ground in Iowa, and Biden is still ahead, by the way, in South Carolina and Nevada. You could have a situation where Bloomberg hurts the two candidates closest to him without winning himself, and I can't see why he would want to do that.
Fascinating. Very quickly, in the minute we have left, I can't let y'all go without asking about Anonymous, the author of a new book that is dropping in a few days. Your newspaper, The Washington Post, EJ, got its hands on a copy. Have you seen a copy?
I have not seen a copy.
What's your take?
Well, there are some fascinating observations in here. I loved the one about Trump seeming like an air traffic controller punching randomly at buttons.
A 12-year-old air traffic controller.
I feel better if Anonymous were public. I think that at this point, this person, he or she, should just come out, leave the administration and say it. And she or he confirmed almost all our worst fears about Trump.
Margaret, we just have a second left. You agree Anonymous should become public?
Here, EJ. I don't know if you and I have ever agreed on so much at once. But absolutely. Look, these civil servants who are serving our country or are testifying before Congress are putting their names on the line. Anonymous should, too.
All right. Amen. That is Margaret Hoover of PBS's Firing Line and EJ Dionne of The Washington Post and Georgetown's McCourt School. Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
And
this is NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Springwell, a nonprofit providing home-based solutions and services for adults and families facing the challenges of aging. Learn more at springwell.com. And Capital Steps, a humorous tonic of music and satire, performing The Lion Kings, Saturday, November 30th at Sanders Theater, boxoffice.harvard.edu.
On Wall Street, the Dow ended up just a small fraction today, about 6 points, to finish the week at 27,681. S&P came close to another record high close. It rose about 0.25% to finish at 3093. The NASDAQ picked up about 0.5% to end the day at 8475. Business news starts at 6:30 with Marketplace. It's 4:19.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sunovion, with a vision for a healthier world, advanced through innovation that helps people living with serious medical conditions. Take on tomorrow. More at Sunovion.com. And Greeno Brand Storytellers, health, technology, science, and business stories since 1999. GreenOUGH.biz/well-told.
The chilly forecast now with meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Lots of clear skies for the rest of the evening. Temperatures hold in the 30s with that gusty wind. And late tonight, we're down in the upper teens to mid-20s. Tomorrow, Saturday, sunshine. It's a cold start. We're only near 40 in the afternoon, less wind. Sunday, partly sunny, lower 50s, breezy. Veterans Day, Monday, partly sunny, low 50s. Some rain around the area for Tuesday and colder.
33 degrees now in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, along with a legacy of putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 30 years ago tomorrow, the Berlin Wall came down, reuniting East and West Germany. And today, there are new dividing lines. Germany took in nearly 1 million refugees in 2015 alone, most of them from the Middle East and North Africa. Anti-immigrant groups have grown, speaking of a new us and them. A far-right party has become the biggest political opposition group in the country. And today, we're going to check in with one Syrian refugee living in Berlin. Our co-host Ari Shapiro first met him 4 years ago on the coast of Turkey.
His name is Ahmad Akkad, but when I met him, he asked me not to use his last name because he hadn't told his family that he was planning to board a crowded raft in Turkey to risk his life crossing the Mediterranean Sea.
Tell me, what's the option? Go back to Syria? Okay, we're gonna die. Stay here, we're gonna die. So this is the only option we have.
He eventually boarded that rubber boat bound for Greece, and once he arrived safely on land, he told us about the journey.
We tried two times. The first time the boat sinked because it was full of people, like 55. We swim back to the beach. So we tried another time. Second time it was okay. We reached Greece safely. No one got hurt.
From Greece, he traveled to Hungary and eventually reached his destination, Germany. He enrolled in a graduate program and started volunteering, helping other recent arrivals from Syria.
I'm living with a family in Fürstenberg. I'm looking for the apartment.
That was back in 2015. Now Akkad is 29 years old, and he jokes that his German has gotten better while his English has gotten worse. Ahmad, welcome back to the program. I'm so happy to talk to you again.
Hi, thank you for the nice introduction that like got me like 4 years back or maybe.
Yeah, what's it longer. Like to hear your own voice describing that journey you made in 2015?
Oh, that got me like really all memories. Like, I don't know, just like I got like views in my head like that time, like traveling like in Turkey, Greece, like all the journey.
Well, tell us about your life today.
I already started with my master's and like going to finish it hopefully this year. I'm working since beginning of 2018 in an engineering company. Like I'm working in power plants. Like I can
You're working
think
on power
like
plants
how the buildings
as an engineer?
Yes, as a civil engineer. I'm living here for 4 years till now, so I feel myself home.
Berlin is this cosmopolitan international city, but across Germany, especially in the former Eastern Germany, there has been a real growth of anti-immigrant sentiment, hate crimes, hostility towards refugees, including Syrians. Is that something that you see?
I went through some situations like that. They are not getting like the full image. We need to clear it for them. We need to help them to go through that by telling them more about ourselves. Like, they don't know us. So I think for sure we're going to be a danger. Like, for humans, what they don't know, they are afraid of.
Can you tell us an experience that you had?
I was in a shop It was like copy shop. I needed like to do some paperwork. There was a guy, from his look, he didn't like me, like the way I look maybe, you know, like the Middle Eastern way, like I look. So I went out when I'm done, he followed me and he told me like, go back to your country, go fight there and stuff like that.
What? How did you respond?
My response, I was like telling him about the situation, like, sorry, do you know like what's going on in Syria? Do you know like what's going to happen if I go back? Hopefully he checked the situation after that and he knows more now what's going on the other half of the war.
You know, Germany is having this debate right now over what makes a person German. How do you answer that question, given that your life is surrounded by people from all over the world in Berlin?
First, I would say it's not going to be a paper. It's not like a piece of paper going to say like, I'm German or I am like from that part of the world. It's not a piece of paper. It's going to be like how you working for the people who's living here, how you are active in the people around you.
When the Berlin Wall fell, you were not yet born. Your family was living in Syria. And so what does tomorrow's anniversary mean for you? Will you be celebrating it? Does it have an important symbolism to you?
Yes, for sure. That's something I'm going to celebrate. And I hope like in the future, all walls going to fall down, like not even in the one country, but between all the countries. We made the walls ourselves. It's not like material walls. It's not like the cement. We have like more walls, and I hope these walls will fall down, and I will try like my best to help in that. We are humans. We are one nation. That's like what I believe in, and that's what I'll try to help to reach.
Ahmad Akkad, it is great talking with you again. Thank you. I'm glad to hear your life is going so well.
Thank you. Thank you, too.
That's Ahmad Akkad, a Syrian refugee now living in Germany, talking with our co-host, Ari Shapiro.
State and federal officials flipped the switch on a $7 million underwater boombox today at a dam in Kentucky. The bioacoustic fish fence is just the latest effort to try to halt the invasive Asian carp. From member station WPLN, Jason Moon Wilkins reports.
Barkley Dam in rural western Kentucky is considered a pinch point for controlling the spread of Asian carp. And with lots of dead fish floating around, it's also kind of a pinch-your-nose point.
Smells great, don't it? Yeah. Carp are already jumping. It might be a good day to see them jump.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Wow.
Looking down, you can see a few fish popping out of the calm, flat lake, but a split second later, that's hundreds and hundreds of carp flying into the air like a big boiling pot around a small electrofishing boat. It's one of the methods used to contain an invasive species brought to the U.S. decades ago to help clean fish ponds and sewage systems. Since then, they've dealt millions in damage to economies and ecosystems. For southern states, the most concerning of the four Asian carp species is silverhead, the leaping kind, famous in viral videos for smacking boaters in the face. They don't like loud noises, and British engineer David Lambert is using that against them by blasting carp with
a bubble curtain. Simple as that.
A bubble curtain doesn't sound intimidating, but each tiny bubble contains noises up to 160 decibels, like the inside of a jet engine, but tuned especially for carp. A U.S. fish biologist calls it a disco barrier, because it also uses lights shooting through the bubbles to scare away fish. Now, Lambert wouldn't describe the sound it makes.
Well, that's the proprietary nature of it, so I'm not going to actually imitate it now.
It's terrifying.
That's journalist Andrew Reeves, who wrote a book on Asian carp. Officials in Canada played him the noise they're using, which he describes as
an outboard motor that is constantly being revved again and again and again.
This system has worked well in other settings, but this will be the biggest field test ever deployed for carp. Reeves says experts are excited, but they've redefined success.
They really don't talk much about eradication simply because they know that at this stage in the game, it's impossible. Asian carp will be a presence in American waterways forever.
If the disco barrier works in Kentucky, officials plan to ask for more funding for other areas as early as next year. For NPR News, I'm Jason Moon Wilkins.
It's NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. A few snow flurries around the area this afternoon, but mainly dry and cold. Tonight dropping to the teens to mid-20s with some blustery winds around. Then for tomorrow, sunshine, but only near 40 degrees. Sunday, partly sunny skies in the low 50s. Monday, partly sunny in the low 50s again.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by The Provider Group, an insurance, brokerage, and benefits firm serving high-net-worth individuals and businesses, working with carriers like Safety Insurance, ProviderIG.com. MFS has taken a traditional approach to fixed income investing for over 40 years. They call it essential fixed income. Learn more at MFS.com. And Boston Playwrights Theater, presenting The Smuggler by Ronan Noon. One man, 9,000 words in rhyme. Now through the 24th. Tickets at bostonplaywrights.org.
I'm Karen Given. In October of 2017, Columbus Crew fans learned that their team was moving to Texas. They gathered in a bar to mourn, but Morgan Hughes wasn't ready to give up.
I sent out a tweet that said, if you think this is over, you're wrong. Tell everyone you know. Hashtag save the crew.
This week on Only a Game, how fans saved the crew. Join us tomorrow at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwahli Saikautau. White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney is defying a subpoena to appear before lawmakers leading the impeachment probe. NPR's Clyde Grisales reports Mulvaney claimed, quote, absolute immunity is preventing him from appearing.
President Trump says he likes to have people he knows testify, but he can't endorse the plan.
I don't want to give credibility to a corrupt witch hunt. I'd love to have Mick go up, frankly. I think it'd do great.
White House counsel told impeachment investigators Mulvaney was directed not to appear. This is according to an official involved in the inquiry investigating claims Trump held up U.S. military aid for a Ukrainian probe of his political opponent. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Washington.
In Hong Kong, anti-Beijing activists are holding candlelight vigils to remember a young man who died today, days after falling off the side of a parking garage where police officers tear-gassed protesters earlier this week. NPR's Julie McCarthy is at the site where the student was mortally injured.
People have come here to honor the life and the death of 22-year-old Chow Tsee Luk, an undergraduate student at the University of Hong Kong Science and Technology. Circumstances surrounding his death are unclear. He suffered from brain injuries that he sustained in a fall in this parking lot in the wee hours of Monday. He teetered between life and death for most of the week. Protesters believe that the police somehow slowed the arrival of medical assistance, and his death is proving to be a rallying point for protesters angry at police and demanding answers from the authorities. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Hong Kong.
Taking a look at Wall Street, the Dow closed up 6 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Joe Biden is the latest Democrat running for president to file for the New Hampshire primary. As WBUR's Anthony Brooks reports, the former vice president turned in papers this afternoon in Concord.
Biden walked through a crowd of rowdy supporters who lined the corridors of the New Hampshire State House as he headed to the Secretary of State's office to file for the first in the nation primary. Afterward, he braved a winter-like chill outside where he told supporters that he'll beat President Trump like a drum. He also took a jab at his progressive opponents, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who are pushing for Medicare for all.
Folks I'm running against or with are saying, well, you can no longer have your private insurance. I think let them make up their own mind. If they don't want their private insurance.
Instead of scrapping private insurance, Biden favors expanding Obamacare with a public option. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Concord, New Hampshire.
A verdict should come Tuesday in the case of a Webster man charged with manslaughter in the death of a state trooper. David Jugunia is accused of driving while high on marijuana and crashing into Trooper Thomas Clardy's cruiser 3 years ago. The defendant claims the crash on the Mass Turnpike in Charlton was the result of a medical event. He had his trial heard by a judge instead of a jury. The city of Boston's reaching out to privately run shelters to make sure enough beds are available for people who are homeless. That's with temperatures tonight expected to drop to the teens. Jim Green is the assistant director of Boston's Street Homeless Initiatives.
You know, everybody's going to step up and make sure that we get as many people inside and safe and warm as we can.
Green says workers with Boston's Public Health Commission will seek out people living on the streets and urge them to come into a shelter. Officials are asking anyone to call 911 if they notice someone who appears to be at risk. Massachusetts hospitals rank 12th in the country when it comes to patient safety. That's according to a new study from the nonprofit Leapfrog Group. In the study, 42% of hospitals in the state received an A grade. That's down from 48% last year. The rankings take into account preventable errors, accidents, injuries, and infections. It's 4:35.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Harvard Art Museums, now showing Crossing Lines, Constructing Home, a contemporary look at migration. HarvardArtMuseums.org.
Boston Bruins are out in Detroit tonight for a game with the Red Wings, and in the forecast, pretty cold around Boston area tonight and throughout the region. Should be in the upper teens to low 20s. Tomorrow, only about 40 degrees for a high with lots of sunshine. Partly sunny skies on Sunday, some clouds around. Temperatures warming to the low 50s. Again in the low 50s on Veterans Day Monday with partly sunny skies. 33 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Indeed. With its skills tests, built for employers who want to see a deeper sense of the person behind the resume. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing. Account registration and more at Zoom.us.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Apple this week became the latest Silicon Valley company to pledge part of its fortune to solving California's affordable housing crisis. But a few billion dollars is just a drop in the bucket compared to the overall problem. California's governor wants to build 3.5 million homes by 2025. A solution like that will require the state and cities to work together. Daryl Steinberg sees the problem from both perspectives. He sits on the governor's homelessness task force, and he's also the Democratic mayor of Sacramento, a city undergoing change.
We're transforming quickly from a capital city government town to a center of tech and food, and it's becoming a real destination city. The great challenge that we face, of course, is affordable housing.
Well, give me a sense of what would be the average price of a single-family home these days in Sacramento?
Well, in one of the nicer neighborhoods in Sacramento, I would say $500,000 or more.
And 10 years ago, where was that price?
Probably $2 to $2.50.
Wow. If the governor were serious about building 3.5 million homes by 2025, that is 6 years from now, give me a sense of how much money would that take total?
Well, with the current prototype that requires $500,000 or more per unit, it would take billions and billions of dollars.
Billions and billions.
And it's not only money, Elsa, it's the time involved.
Right.
Because it can take 2 to 3 to 5 years to get through the entitlement and planning process to get to construction of a major unit. So we don't have time, you know.
So does the governor's plan seem overambitious, 3.5 million homes in just 6 years?
I think you have to have a stretch goal. I mean, you have to have a vision. So I think that's the right thing.
Well, I mean, the challenge isn't just about money. There are other hurdles out there. Can you explain what you see as the biggest political hurdles?
Yes, money is not the only problem. There are major problems around where to site affordable housing. And that's the complicated relationships between state and local government, where local government says, don't tell us how to run our cities or how much housing to build or where to build it. And mm-hmm. the state saying, I think appropriately, we have a statewide crisis here, and we need some local jurisdictions that are not doing their fair share to do more. There's also the difficulty that it's the easiest thing in the world, seemingly, to stop a good project if you're anybody who doesn't want that kind of housing in their backyard.
And there's also the issue of zoning. I mean, there are cities that can't or won't build high-density housing in places that they're currently not allowed to.
When I refer to the push and pull between state and local government, I'm really talking about the zoning issue, because cities can determine where they want to build housing, and in some instances, essentially, whether they want to build housing or affordable housing at all.
Right. So how do you incentivize cities like yours to build more high-density housing near, say, mass transit?
Well, you both incentivize it by putting your affordable housing resources towards the kind of housing you want to see and where you want to see it. But I also believe that the state has a proper regulatory role to tell local governments that you have to zone for more affordable housing. That's been the law for a long time. But Governor Newsom has said it's time to more aggressively enforce those laws, because unless every city and every county is doing their fair share and more, and we collectively are overcoming the not-in-my-backyard phenomena, the stretch goal is going to remain a large stretch goal.
Mayor Daryl Steinberg of Sacramento, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Elsa.
Are the presidential candidates equipped to increase a sense of unity and civility in the country? That question was top of mind for Michael Logan and Jackie Stahl, two undecided voters NPR brought to the table with South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg this week. They met in a restaurant with Weekend Edition host Scott Simon.
Thanks for being with us, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Welcome to South Bend.
Voter Michael Logan shared a story about something he witnessed recently at a restaurant in Michigan.
An elderly gentleman came in, and he had on a Make America Great hat. You know, a couple of 20-some-year-olds came in after him, and they told him to take his hat off, and, you know, you shouldn't be here with that hat on.
And Logan pressed Buttigieg on how he'd go about healing the growing political divisions in this country.
If you can't wear a hat, regardless of what your political affiliation is, without someone confronting you about that, I don't think that that atmosphere existed before Donald Trump became president. And I think he's just fueled the fire. How do we get back to the civility?
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans right now are getting ready for Thanksgiving, wondering how the meals conversation is going to go, because, you know, these fences have gone up even within families. So much depends on how the president acts and how the president talks. It's not just about running the government. It's about setting a tone. And that part Absolutely. Of the job, it's not written down anywhere. It's not in the law. It's not in the job description. But it might be where you earn your paycheck the most when you're in charge. I found in the military that I was interacting with people who were so different from me. But we learned to trust each other. One of the reasons I'm a big fan of voluntary national service, creating a lot of civilian national service opportunities, I think that a lot of people would have a common experience that they could carry with them for the rest of their lives, in the same way that diverse groups of veterans can always kind of talk to each other, joke with each other, bust each other's chops in a way that just kind of brings them together.
That thing in common.
Yeah, I want more Americans to have that. So some of the, I think, programs and policies will help, but a lot of it, honestly, is just the message you send.
If you became the Democratic presidential nominee, there will be debates. Mm-hmm. We assume President Trump, who has said some things we have noted about people at the border, said some things about people who live in African countries, made other remarks that have disparaged other people. You walk out on that stage, do you shake hands with him?
I'll shake hands with him. He's the president of the United States. But doesn't mean I agree with him. Doesn't mean I endorse any of the things that he has said, and I will confront him.
Jackie, I know you have some concerns about this too.
Yeah, you know, you really have seen the shift over these past 4 years of the hostility, people, the anger. How do we turn that around? How can you, you know, gain the trust and respect back from people? And, you know, I don't want to be naive, but, you know, have just a more, you know, peaceful United States.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's always going to be challenges and disagreements, but it doesn't have to be like this. Part of it, I think, is the need for us to have a common purpose. I'm thinking about things that we're going to have to fight together, like climate change. It's just one example of an area where we can find something bigger than ourselves, be part of it, get to work.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's something that all Americans today can rally around and agree on? Do you think that that exists right now?
Well, I think to put it simply, we all want to be okay. I don't think everybody feels a burning need to become wealthy, but everybody needs to know that they're going to be okay, that they're going to be able to provide for their kids. If we can at least agree that that's our common purpose, to be physically safe and to make sure that we economically are able to live lives of our choosing, that would be something everybody can get behind, even as we're hashing it out over what it's going to take to get there.
That is South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg speaking to NPR Scott Simon and two undecided voters. You can watch their whole conversation and more discussions between voters and presidential candidates at npr.org/offscript.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. North Carolina is the nation's largest grower and exporter of tobacco. So when the crop was included in retaliatory tariffs from China, it hit the state hard. Paul Garber of member station WFDD reports what the tariffs have meant for farmers in North Carolina.
Brent and Sue Leggett have grown tobacco for 15 years. There are several small barns where fans hum as they cure the harvested crop before it's sold. People around here call this the golden leaf. And Sue points to a packed tractor trailer.
This truck is ready to go to market. We've got a load of 52 bales of tobacco ready to be sold.
Before the China tariffs, North Carolina tobacco farmers already faced a staggering triple threat. Declining demand as fewer people smoke, crop losses from three tropical systems, and tightened global competition as a strong dollar puts U.S. farms at a competitive disadvantage. And then another problem. When the Trump administration ordered tariffs against China last year, the Chinese retaliated and implemented their own tariffs, including ones targeting U.S. agricultural products like tobacco. That created an unprecedented level of uncertainty for what was once North Carolina's most stable crop. As a result, Brent Leggett says they've planted less tobacco this year, a loss of $100,000.
I don't know of a grower in North Carolina that has a plan for next year. Survival is the plan right now.
China Tobacco Incorporated, the state-run monopoly, once bought as much as 80 million pounds of North Carolina tobacco annually. This year, virtually none. It's estimated that state's farmers have lost $250 million over the last 2 years. Tobacco is different from most other crops hit by the trade war. The federal government will pay more than $14 billion to U.S. farmers this year after the China market eroded for about 24 agricultural exports such as soybeans, corn, and wheat. But tobacco farmers aren't eligible for that money. Federal anti-smoking rules prohibit government financial assistance, so there's no payout for tobacco farmers and no buyers for what had been going to China. In warehouses across North Carolina, there's more than a year's worth of tobacco exports sitting unsold.
The market is very depressed.
That's Steve Troxler, North Carolina's agriculture commissioner and a former tobacco farmer.
So, you know, the question is, if I raise it, is it going to be profitable? And, you know, if you're not going to turn a profit, then why would you do it?
And Troxler says that's what the state's 2,200 tobacco farmers are wrestling with right now.
We know that farming is a risky business, there's no question, but I have seen the tears in farmers' eyes and running down their cheeks that I never thought I would see ever.
Rob Turner's family has farmed tobacco for more than 100 years. His son recently joined the family business in Nash County, the largest tobacco-producing region in the state. They had contracts to grow for China tobacco. Turner is not sure the overseas business will ever come back.
Are you optimistic about your son's prospects of being a tobacco farmer?
I used to be. Now it's questionable. Once these tariffs are eliminated or settled, you can talk to me then.
Turner says the two sides in the trade war are arguing over policies that have nothing to do with agriculture, leaving the farmers like him and hundreds of others paying the price. For NPR News, I'm Paul Garber in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. SBLI, founded in 1907 by future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, SBLI is committed to providing families with straightforward life insurance. SBLI.com. And Mass General Hospital, the number one research hospital in America, developing innovative treatments for complex conditions to get you back to the life you love. Mass General, revolutionizing care.
After a blustery day today, we should have a clear and pretty cold night tonight, down in the low 20s or even the teens by tomorrow morning. And tomorrow, sunny, inching toward 40, could top 50 on Sunday and Monday, Veterans Day, with partly sunny skies. Stay with WBUR and NPR next Wednesday and Friday for complete live coverage and analysis of the first public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Live coverage of the House impeachment inquiry public hearings this Wednesday and Friday, next Wednesday and Friday, on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Brain drain is a global phenomenon. Take Germany, for instance, where the economy is still reintegrating decades after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
The best, most motivated and mobile people get up and went to the West and made their living there.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Germany's invisible economic wall. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Math is a field that is dominated by men. Yet, young boys and girls seem to be no different in math ability. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a new study comparing the brain activity of boys and girls doing basic math.
In high school, boys are about twice as likely as girls to get top scores on standardized math tests. But Jessica Cantlin of Carnegie Mellon University says that doesn't mean male brains have an inherent advantage.
When we're seeing differences in adult brains or behavior, we don't necessarily know the history of how those differences came about.
It could be nurture or nature. To learn more, Cantlin and a team of scientists studied brain activity patterns in more than 100 children. Their ages ranged from 3 to 10, and Cantlin says the kids spent up to half an hour in the noisy confines of a magnetic resonance scanner.
We had boys and girls watch educational videos about mathematics while they were being scanned.
Including this clip from Sesame Street.
1 and 2 and 3, counting is our favorite thing.
Then, Cantlin says, the team looked to see which brain networks became active during math tasks.
If you define the mathematics network in girls and you define the mathematics network in boys, they're indistinguishable.
Cantlin suspects that the math gender gap reflects societal messages more than biology. She also says that even though more women are entering math and science these days, it can still be daunting to choose a field dominated by men.
You can look even now at ratios of women and men participating in different activities, and you can get the hint.
Cantlin says her study doesn't rule out the possibility that male brains acquire a math advantage during adolescence.
What we're showing here is at least very early in development, they don't start out that way.
The brain activity study appears in the journal Science of Learning. And David Geary of the University of Missouri says the results aren't terribly surprising.
Because typically we don't see sex differences at the ages assessed in this study or for the types of math tasks that they did, which were fairly simple.
Geary says differences seem to show up later and involve very high-level math tasks. His own research has found that in most countries, female students perform just as well as male students in science-related subjects. Yet paradoxically, Geary says, females are less likely to get degrees in fields like math and computer science if they live in wealthier countries with greater gender equality.
As things get better in a country, people follow their interests more and they go with their academic strengths and worry a little bit less about how much money they're going to make.
Geary says the most obvious gender gap in education worldwide doesn't involve math or science. It's reading and writing abilities, where boys lag well behind girls. Erin Faley of St. John's University was part of a study that found something similar in the U.S.
Across the entire United States, there's not really a gender achievement gap in math.
but there is a gender achievement gap in reading.
Bailey says the exception is affluent areas, where boys are closer to girls in reading ability and have an edge when it comes to math. Bailey says that suggests that girls in some areas are constrained by stereotypes around gender, but she says so are boys.
And that's reflected in the fact that essentially every U.S. school district, boys are scoring lower on average than girls in reading and language arts.
Which may help explain why boys often choose math and science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
A year after flames broke out, Paradise, California is still trying to come back from a devastating wildfire that killed 86. Just 3,000 people have returned to a town that was once home to 27,000. Many are commuting to school from other cities and towns, and that includes almost all of the Paradise High School football team, the Bobcats. The team is undefeated, and as NPR's Eric Westervelt reports, the Bobcats have given the fire-scarred town a much-needed shot of hope.
Paradise is pledging to return to normal, but with normal still years away, the town has gladly embraced the Bobcats' extraordinary season.
Here we go! Get it done! Get them! Wrap up! Yeah!
At practice, defensive players face off in a tackle competition. Burnt tree stumps dot the edge of the football field. At stake in this drill, pride and push-ups.
Come on, baby, come on! Oh! Hey, push-up position, let's go!
Here we go, ready?
One, two.
After the fire, the team vowed to make a championship run, and they've delivered. The Bobcats are 10-0 and likely heading to the playoffs. They've done it behind a juggernaut running game. They average more than 400 rushing yards a game. That ranks them third in the state and ninth nationally. Senior running back Lucas Hartley has almost 1,200 yards. 6'2" sophomore Tyler Harrison leads the team with an astonishing, well, let him tell you.
1,837.
1,837 yards.
Yeah.
Are you buying the O-line a bunch of burgers or what?
Yeah, at the end of the season, I'm buying them everything, anything they want.
Hey, be careful. I got
yeah,
that on tape.
I know.
The team's season, this run, almost didn't happen.
All of us were out of our homes. We weren't sure we were going to have school. We weren't sure I was going to have a job. There's just so many questions.
Head coach Rick Prinz, in his 21st season here, says just 22 students showed up for summer training in a donated warehouse in nearby Chico. They were all distressed, displaced. Coach Prinz gathered them in a patch of gravel behind that warehouse.
We didn't even have a football. So we said, I think Danny, our quarterback, has one. So he went and got it out of his trunk and started running plays with the kids and had no idea where we were going from there, but we were also kind of distraught and kind of still in shock and just wanted to move forward and do something for the kids.
Maybe it'd be easy now to write that feel-good screenplay, Football Saves Town, details at 11. Of course, it's not that simple. Parents are struggling with weather and how to rebuild. Some students, Coach Prince says, have struggled in school and with attendance. Today, they're scattered across these Sierra foothills. Only three on the varsity team now live in Paradise. The rest commute. Some up to 90 minutes. But Prince says when practices started in earnest, he saw something, a change.
You could just see it in their demeanor and their faces that finally something normal, something they could focus on that was not so devastating from what they went through. And kids started coming back.
Eventually, enough came back to field full JV and varsity teams. Of the nearly 300 boys at Paradise High School today, nearly 100 of them play football.
The field itself is the most thing that's felt like home since the fire.
Senior Caston Ortiz plays right tackle on the offense. Everywhere, every day, he says, the players see and smell reminders of the deadly fire.
The burnt stumps, you see still some of the buildings that haven't been cleaned up yet. You see just flat lots in town. But I think when we step foot on this field and we see the green grass and we see each other padded up, it feels right at home. And, you know, we feel like a family out here.
As the sun fades, key members of the field goal unit watch a 40-yarder sail straight through the uprights.
There we go.
That was a good one.
The team and community will have to wait for results of a game tonight and then a playoff seeding meeting tomorrow morning to find out if they make the postseason. They're confident they'll get in, as confident as they are in their running game, running with the community on their backs. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Paradise, California.
And thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Neon with Parasite, a dark comedy thriller about two very different families whose fates cross in a tale of class, greed, and deception. Now playing in select cities, Parasite-Movie for more theater info. Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And Hiscox. Hiscox tailors its policies to fit the unique needs of each small business. Quotes and information on insurance policies are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts.
We've had a few snow flurries around the region, mostly inland. This evening, sky should be clear. It should feel increasingly cold, down in the teens or low 20s by tomorrow morning. Tomorrow, a hard freeze in the early hours, although temperature should eventually rise to about 40. Plenty of sun tomorrow. Then for Sunday and the holiday Monday, partly sunny, inching to the low 50s. Freezing out there right now, 32 degrees in the Boston area at 1 before 5.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sunovion, with a vision for a healthier world, advanced through innovation that helps people living with serious medical conditions. Take on tomorrow. More at Sunovion.com.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Coming up, this week's election results and what they mean for gun control. Virginia's Democratic governor has reintroduced gun control legislation after Democrats won back control of the state house.
It's time for legislators, for our leaders to come to Richmond and take votes and pass laws. And that's what I expect will happen in January.
I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead, why the U.S. should get American nuclear weapons out of Turkey. Gorlitz, Germany, lost most of its population after the Berlin Wall came down 30 years ago.
It was catastrophic. It looked like a city in ruins. It wasn't in good shape.
But now it is, thanks to tourism and the film industry. And some electric vehicle owners in California are getting creative as power blackouts continue to affect the state. Some of them are powering their homes with their cars. It's 1 past 5. News headlines are next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. House impeachment investigators released transcripts from two additional witnesses today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports the transcripts are from the National Security Council Ukraine analyst, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, and former White House advisor Fiona Hill.
Vindman and Hill each testified behind closed doors last month about their knowledge of efforts by President Trump and his attorney Rudy Giuliani to get Ukraine's president to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter's involvement in Ukraine. Hill testified that Ambassador Gordon Sondland, a major Trump donor with no previous diplomatic experience, told her that Trump had put him in charge of Ukraine policy, but she said Sondland had, in her words, gone off the road with no guardrails and no GPS. Vindman testified that Sondland told him there was no ambiguity that Trump wanted an investigation into the Bidens in return for a meeting the Ukrainian president sought. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has had a change of mind and now says there should be no public hearings in the impeachment inquiry. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports his comments come after the White House and supporters complained about the investigation being held behind closed doors.
President Trump says he's not concerned about any of the people who testified that he pressured his Ukrainian counterpart to investigate a political rival. Trump said the only thing that matters is the transcript of the July 25th call between him and the Ukrainian president. He blamed criticism on bias of people who didn't have firsthand knowledge and so-called never-Trumpers.
Well, they shouldn't be having public hearings. This is a hoax. This is just like the Russian witch hunt.
When departing for Atlanta, President Trump was asked about why his acting chief of staff won't be allowed to testify. Trump said he didn't want to give credibility to a corrupt investigation. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is campaigning in Atlanta today, where he's launching what his campaign is calling Black Voices for Trump. That group will focus on recruiting and mobilizing African Americans who support the president. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Germany defending the Trump administration policies on tariffs and NATO spending. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports Pompeo also urged Western allies to work together to face modern threats.
On his final day of a two-day visit, Pompeo met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin to mark the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Pompeo said the West was wrong to think that free societies would flourish everywhere after the end of communism. He singled out Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Chinese Communist Party as examples.
NPR's Rob Schmitz reporting. Wall Street higher by the closing bell, with the S&P 500 ending in record territory. The Dow up 6 points at 27,681. The Nasdaq up 40 points at 84.75. The S&P 500 up 7 points at 30.93. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Former Republican Massachusetts U.S. Senator Scott Brown will have a new job next year. Today, he was named the new president and dean at New England Law Boston. The law school will bring in Brown in December of next year. He's now U.S. ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa. One of the front runners in the Democratic presidential race is now qualified to be on the ballot for the New Hampshire primary. Today, former Vice President Joe Biden registered for the first in the nation primary. Afterwards, he addressed supporters outside the statehouse in Concord.
I've learned two things in the last several weeks. One is that Vladimir Putin doesn't want me to be president. All those bots he's put out, his army of bots on the internet. But also that Donald Trump doesn't want me to be the nominee.
Tech entrepreneur Andrew Yang also signed up for the primary today. No date has been set for the election. Investigators say the general manager at the Buffalo Wild Wings sports bar in Burlington died after two cleaning chemicals were accidentally mixed. The worker was overcome by hazardous fumes last night in the restaurant's kitchen. 10 other workers and customers complained of having difficulty breathing and burning eyes. A state trooper is no longer facing criminal charges after he was accused of committing lewd acts while he was off duty at a concert in Gillette Stadium. A Wrentham District Court judge today dismissed the case against Andrew Patterson after no witnesses came forward to testify against him. Patterson says he is the victim here.
My family's been harassed. My reputation has been tarnished. My source of income and health care has been removed. All of this has been done without due process, without being present in a court of law until this day.
Patterson remains suspended as state police conduct their own investigation. Bruins are out in Detroit tonight to take on the Red Wings, and in the forecast, we should have clear and really cold night ahead tonight, down in the low 20s or even the teens by tomorrow morning. Tomorrow's sunshine inching toward 40, could top 50 on Sunday and Monday, with partly sunny skies both days. 32 degrees now in Boston at 6 past 5.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Carbonite, protecting email, spreadsheets, calendars, and more with Carbonite. Because businesses can stop when they lose data. Carbonite, cloud backup for small businesses. And Home Advisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can read reviews, book appointments, and check cost guides for home projects at homeadvisor.com or on the mobile app.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. When Virginia Democrats swept control of the State House this week, one factor some voters cited was gun control. In May, a mass shooting in Virginia Beach killed 12 people. Afterwards, Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat, convened a special session of the state legislature.
He had hoped to pass gun control measures, what he called common sense legislation. But Republicans were in control. They shelved the bills and ended the special session after just 90 minutes. Fast forward to this week.
I have one question for you. Do you all like the color blue? I said, do you like the color blue? Because I'm here to officially declare today, November the 5th, 2019, that Virginia is officially blue. Congratulations.
Democrats will take control of the legislature in January.
Governor Northam joins me now from the governor's office in Richmond. Governor Northam, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You and I last spoke shortly after that awful day in Virginia Beach and the shooting. You introduced 8 measures then. We don't have time to tick through all of them, but they have to do with background checks, with red
yes.
flag laws, with bans. Will you be pushing for that same agenda this time or even more?
Absolutely. I will start with those eight pieces of what I call common sense gun legislation. They have been proven to save lives, and that's what we want to do in Virginia. So we will start with those pieces of legislation. I'm sure there will be others that will be introduced. I think they will be well vetted in both the House and the Senate. And, you know, depending on what gets to my desk, I'll certainly consider those. And if we feel that they'll make Virginia safer, we'll move forward with them as well.
Is your sense that any Republican minds have been changed on this issue? Do you have any hope of buy-in from Republican lawmakers?
It's an interesting question. And, you know, we were inundated with commercials and mailers during the campaign. And so some of the Republicans ran on common sense gun legislation. So I look forward to seeing their response. I think that they listen to voters. I know they do. And seeing how this election went on Tuesday, I hope that they'll be at the table. They should be. This shouldn't be a partisan issue.
May I ask about one specific change you advocated before, and it sounds like it's on your list, an assault weapons ban.
Yes.
What is your plan for assault weapons currently owned by Virginians that are already out there? Will you confiscate them?
No, ma'am, not at this stage. We're looking at the banning the sales of assault weapons. We'll certainly, you know, again, vet these pieces of legislation, but that would be what we would start with.
You would propose a ban on sales going forward?
Absolutely.
Okay. In terms of pushback that you received last time, I'm curious about one other thing and whether it has changed. There's been a lot of reporting on the NRA and their leadership challenges and funding challenges. Is your sense that there is as much energy in the pro-gun rights lobby in your state as there was, I don't know, back in May or a year ago?
You know, that certainly the advocacy is still out there. But, you know, I think that, the you know, for Virginians to experience what happened in our backyard on Memorial Day weekend, you know, I think the influence of the NRA, especially in Virginia, has weakened. Yes, ma'am, and I think we'll continue to see that.
But their pockets are deep, and so is their influence, particularly in a southern state like Virginia. Are you confident that you can overcome the power of that lobby and actually get eight pieces of legislation through the state house?
I am, because the Virginian spoke on Tuesday, and that's the most powerful thing out there is their vote, and they did that despite the money that the NRA poured into Virginia.
And can you get this done if you don't get any Republican buy-in? Are the votes there?
Yes, ma'am, they are. I don't know of any Democrats that would be opposed to these eight pieces of common sense legislation that we have proposed in the past, and we will do again in January.
Last thing, as you speak to voters in Virginia, what do they tell you? What is your sense of to what extent the gun issue was mobilizing people at the polls this week?
It was a large factor, and, you know, I saw that. The tragedy that we had in Virginia, and then the Republicans' response when I brought them back to Richmond to just spend less than 90 minutes talking about common sense gun legislation, that was a large factor. And people have said enough is enough. And, you know, we've been talking about these things, but now we have the opportunity to take action, and that's what we intend to do in January.
May I point out, you still sound kind of bitter about that less than 90 minutes in January. Are you hand over heart determined to reach across the aisle and try to get Republicans on board this time around?
I will, and I think probably folks know of my history. I served in the United States Army. I took care of wounded soldiers. I'm also a pediatrician, so I've seen what happens when toddlers pick up loaded firearms on the bedside table. So I have heard enough well-intended people say that our thoughts and prayers are with these families. But now it's time for legislators, for our leaders, to come to Richmond and take votes and pass laws. And that's what I expect will happen in January.
Governor, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always good talking to you.
And you. That's Ralph Northam. He is the governor of Virginia.
It was a proposal to deny undocumented immigrants access to public services like health care or education. We're talking not about the latest policy from the Trump administration, but a ballot initiative that was approved in California 25 years ago today. It was called Prop 187. Proponents of the measure made the argument that it was necessary to help the state's economic woes, but of course, not everyone agreed. It was a measure that has had lasting political ramifications. LA Times reporter Gustavo Arellano has been chronicling the saga of Prop 187 for the podcast Latino USA. Welcome.
Gracias for having me.
So what's interesting about this whole story of Prop 187 is that California today is a sanctuary state, of course, but it would have been really hard to see it be anything like a sanctuary state back in 1994. Can you just tell us why Prop 187 was so popular back then?
Yeah, we have to go back 25 years. So immigration has been coming to California in unprecedented numbers, this time from Latin America and Asia. So a lot of people are upset with the cultural shifts. And at the same time, we're going through our worst recession since the Great Depression. Middle-class voters, they need a scapegoat. And so they find it with people who don't look like them, who speak a different language, and more importantly, whose children are starting to go to these schools. Whether they were legal or not really wasn't the question. It was really, hey, we have a scapegoat. Let's try something.
But Prop 187 became kind of a galvanizing moment for a lot of Latinx activists. I want to play something from one of your episodes. This is from Gerardo Correa. He was just a teenager at the time, and he remembers reacting to a slogan that Prop 187 advocates kept using, save our state.
Save our state from what? From me? Like, I'm a threat to you? Like, I'm a law-abiding citizen. I'm going, trying to go to school. I'm trying to better myself. Like, how am I the threat?
And what Correa says in this episode is he wasn't political at all before Prop 187, but the whole campaign against it made him start caring about politics. Did you find that that was a common story talking to people?
It is the story of my generation of Latinos, like Gen X and maybe a little bit younger, a little bit older. Literally, I was a sophomore in high school in 1994. I was just your typical,
I was
American
senior.
Kid. Yeah, hey, we're not too far apart. You know, I liked baseball. I liked, you know, In Living Color back in the day. And all of a sudden, people start attacking immigrants. And it was personal for me and for all of us because my dad came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy. He ended up becoming an American citizen. We had the 3-bedroom, 2-bath, swimming pool, American dream. And now all of a sudden we're the cause of California. So we would have been completely assimilated if not for this. We saw this as an existential threat. So a lot of people went into politics, went into advocacy. I became a reporter because of 187.
So interesting. You were just a sophomore. But I remember reading that while your classmates were protesting and walking out of school because of Prop 187, you decided not to. Tell me why you decided not to.
Honestly, I was scared. I was scared.
Scared of what?
I've never done something like this. My parents are still immigrants. I'm afraid that the police is going to round me up. They're going to go after my parents. And I also thought that it would do nothing. That walking out, what could us kids do to try to stop this 187? How is that going to stop people from hating us? And by the way, I talk about it in my podcast. I was maybe one of 5 students left in 5th period history
in
class.
In that classroom.
And we're all looking at each other saying, we made a mistake.
Did it feel a little bit shameful to be sitting there?
I was embarrassed for years afterwards. And I got so ashamed of that that I said, you know what? I'm never going to care about politics ever again. I was against 187, of course, because my dad was undocumented.
Yeah.
I'm just going to, you know, become successful and buy a house and in a gated community and never have to think about it again. But it came back to me.
Little did you know. Now, Prop 187, it ended up getting challenged in the courts. It was dead by 1999. You argue, though, that it still has a profound lasting impact on American politics. Tell me, when you were listening today to the debate over immigration, what feels incredibly familiar to you about it?
The template, demonizing undocumented people, creating legislation that's going to target them, specifically going after the children, and politicians using this to win. So in 1994, it's not just the story of 187. It's also the story of former California Governor Pete Wilson, who was running behind in his reelection campaign, saw that illegal immigration was an issue that he could win on, and he won it. Exactly with President Trump. You know, in his very first speech, remember, he said people coming across the border were rapists, were drug smugglers, and some of them, I think, are good people.
Right.
That's exactly the
rhetoric.
Back
in June 2015.
And I cannot overemphasize how much 187, yes, it inspired a generation of Latinx activists, but also inspired a generation of immigration restrictionists. SB 1070 comes from this, from Arizona. Legislation in Pennsylvania and Oklahoma, the main immigrant control group, Federation for American Immigration Reform. I interviewed the president, Dan Stein, and he said, yeah, with 187, we learned what to do and what not to do.
Gustavo Arellano reports for the LA Times. Thank you very much for coming into the studio today.
Gracias for having me.
The This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
WBUR CitySpace welcomes former UN Ambassador Samantha Power to discuss her new book, The Education of an Idealist. It's December 6th. Go to wbur.org/cityspace.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Ballet's The Nutcracker, a holiday treat for the whole family opening November 29th. Make memories to cherish with the ones you love. BostonBallet.org. And East Meets West Catering, more than 30 years of culinary and event experience, catering holiday celebrations inspired by you. EMWCatering.com.
Coming up next on All Things Considered, the benefit of having an electric car during a power outage. The Dow ended up just a small fraction today, about 6 points higher to finish the week at 27,681. S&P almost hit another record high close. It rose about 0.25% to end the day at 3093. And the NASDAQ picked up about 0.5% to finish at 8475. It's 19 past five.
Funding for WBUR's business report comes from MFS Investment Management. For over 40 years, MFS has taken a traditional approach to fixed income, helping investment professionals help their clients. Learn more about essential fixed income at MFS.com.
The forecast now with meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Plenty of clear skies around this evening as you're headed home. Temperatures are in the 30s. We fall to the 20s by about 11 or 12 o'clock and into the upper teens. Even low 20s tomorrow morning in Boston. For Saturday, sunshine, temperature near 40. There's a hard freeze in the morning. Sunday, a blend of clouds and sun. Not as chilly, but breezy. Temperatures in the low 50s. Veterans Day, Monday, a blend of clouds and sun. Again, temperatures in the lower 50s. Rain moves in for Tuesday, and it turns much colder after that.
32 degrees now in the Boston area. This is 90.9 WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting The Good Liar, a suspense thriller about the secrets people keep and the lies they live, starring Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen. The Good Liar, rated R, only in theaters November 15th. And Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, developing ways to use the PD-L1 pathway in immunotherapy to treat cancer. Committed to making contributions in cancer treatment for 72 years, DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The president of Turkey is due to visit the White House next week. No shortage of thorny issues for him and President Trump to discuss. The U.S. military pullback from the Turkey-Syria border, the fighting that ensued when Turkey sent its troops across that border, the dispute over whether to sell U.S. F-35 fighter jets to Turkey. The list goes on. And then there's this. What to do about the U.S. nuclear weapons inside Turkey? That's right, 50 or so of them. Stephen Pfeiffer, a former U.S. ambassador, now a William Perry Fellow and nuclear expert at Stanford University, joined me now. Hi, Ambassador.
Hi, happy to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Describe this current situation. Where exactly are these weapons? Who's guarding them?
Today, they're, according to the Federation of American Scientists, about 150 American nuclear weapons in five countries in Europe. And 50 of those are at the Incirlik Air Force Base in Turkey. It's in southwestern Turkey, about 60 miles from the Syrian border. Now, the weapons themselves are under U.S. custody and U.S. guard, but they're at a Turkish facility.
And so they are guarded, what, by NATO, by Turkish forces?
No, the weapons themselves are actually guarded by American personnel. There's a special American munitions unit there. And then, of course, the facility overall is guarded by the Turks.
And why does the U.S. have nuclear weapons there? What's the history here?
This goes back actually to the 1950s, is that the United States has maintained nuclear weapons in Europe, both for deterrence purposes, but also to assure NATO allies of the American commitment to their defense. The Federation of American Scientists says they're located in Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, Italy, and Turkey. But the relationship we have with Turkey now is a lot more difficult than with those other four countries.
So much so that you argue that the U.S. should be thinking about how to get these weapons out. Make the case for why they should no longer be in Turkey.
Well, first of all, let me say that with 100 American nuclear weapons based in four NATO countries, those should suffice to serve both the purposes of deterrence and also the purposes of assuring allies. But given the way that the relationship with Turkey has gone over the last several years, Turkey's opted, instead of buying an American air defense missile, to buy something from Russia, and that's made it difficult for us to consider selling them the F-35 fighter plane. you saw the Turkish move militarily into Syria in a way that really took no account of American interests. And there's this sort of volatility between President Trump, who has several times tweeted that he is prepared to devastate the Turkish economy, and then the Turkish President Erdogan. And it just seems to me that this would be a better time to bring those weapons out. It's something that we don't need, and it's time for them to come home.
Couldn't one make the argument that maybe it's better to leave them be in the service of not further upsetting the Turks, further destabilizing a relationship that, as you note, that is already shaky?
My argument then would be there ought to be better ways to improve this relationship. The presence of American nuclear weapons elsewhere in Europe allows us to extend the same nuclear deterrent umbrella over Turkey. They just physically don't have to be at Incirlik.
What about the argument that the presence of U.S. nuclear weapons maybe deters Turkey from trying to get its own nukes?
I would argue that the extended American nuclear deterrent covers Turkey as a member of NATO, but it doesn't require that nuclear weapons be physically present in Turkey.
But setting aside requirements, you will have seen President Erdogan in September said maybe it's time for Turkey to think about getting its own nuclear bomb. This is on his mind.
And that actually seems to me an additional reason why we've got to pull our nuclear weapons out of the Air Force base there in Turkey.
Would you need to get other NATO members on board? Would they need to sign off?
There would probably have to be consultations within NATO. But I'm not sure this would be a usually controversial issue. What most NATO countries would like in terms of an American nuclear presence is having some nuclear weapons in Europe, basically to demonstrate, particularly in this case now to the Russians, that there is that American security commitment. I would argue that American nuclear weapons on the territory of four NATO members should suffice.
Ambassador Pfeiffer, thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Pfeiffer of Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation.
About half of all the electric cars in the country are owned in California, and they're at the center of what's becoming a statewide struggle for electric power. Thousands of customers are being cut off the grid on a regular basis, and it's even worse during the state's wildfire season. But as NPR's Vanessa Romo reports, some electric car owners are finding new ways to power up.
The call from the city came at 4 in the morning. The Getty Fire on the west side of L.A. was spreading. It'd gotten too close to Mandeville Canyon, the hillside neighborhood where Lawrence Levy lives. He had to evacuate.
I left without too much of anything, just basically meds, and I wasn't thinking about a whole bunch of clothes or anything like that.
Something else he didn't have to think about? His electric Chevy Bolt.
I had a half a tank.
That was more than enough power to get him out of danger.
I drove around town that day quite a bit and then went over to the valley, and I had about 25 miles left in the tank by the time I got there.
That's when he finally had to think about recharging. He usually plugs into a solar-powered battery in his garage, but that was impossible this time. Then he remembered a nearby public charger.
But it was broken.
And with that, range anxiety set in. If he didn't plug in soon, he'd be stranded. It's a problem a lot of electric car owners are facing, as blackouts are becoming more and more frequent. Frustrated, Levy turned to a trusty Facebook group for Bolt owners. Lately, they've got a lot to say about what they're doing during the blackouts. But Levy wanted to know, where are the cheap charging stations? Turns out there was one at a mall a few miles away.
Free completely, didn't pay a dime.
Levy's only owned a car for 8 months. And already, he says, he'll never go back. Despite the inconvenience and the evacuations in his future, he's confident he'll always be able to charge his car, because California's got more public charging stations than any state. About 18,000 of them.
Pop the hood.
For Clarence Dold, the Kincaid Fire in Santa Rosa, where he lives, presented a different kind of challenge. He hasn't been evacuated, but he has lost power 3 times in the last month. The longest stretch lasted 4 days. But unlike Levy, who found himself in a bit of a jam driving the electric car, Dold's 2013 Nissan Leaf was kind of a lifesaver, or lightsaber. He used the car like a generator to power the house.
So this is just like you would do jumping a car to get it started because you left your lights on or something?
Standing in the garage of the ranch house, he shows me how he runs jumper cables from the Leaf's battery to an inverter. A box about the size of a dictionary that changes DC power to AC. The rest he does with heavy-duty extension cords that he runs into the main rooms of the house. One goes to the fridge. The whole thing cost about $200, a fraction of the price of a generator. Those can run up into the thousands.
So we were watching TV and had a cold fridge and a couple of lights and things seemed normal.
Every few hours, Dold says, he'd climb into the small car to check the battery, just to make sure the house wasn't depleting the car of too much power. If it was, he'd disconnect the cables and drive 5 miles away to recharge.
The power outages are not over a broad area. This isn't like a hurricane hitting Florida.
That whole time, the rest of the neighborhood was a cacophony of gas and electric generators. Meanwhile, his Nissan Leaf was virtually silent. For Dold and other enterprising electric car owners like him, that's the secret sauce to surviving a blackout. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Continued cold this evening and overnight tonight, dropping to the low 20s or even the teens by tomorrow morning with a hard freeze in the early hours tomorrow. Sunny and breezy and chilly eventually tomorrow, not quite as cold, right about 40 degrees. Then for Sunday and Veterans Day Monday, sunshine mixed in with clouds. Should be a little bit milder in the low 50s tops. 32 degrees now in Boston at 5:30.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Lyric Opera with Fellow Travelers, a new opera. Two men are swept up in a passionate love affair during the McCarthy era, November 13th to 17th. Tickets at BLO.org. And the Elie Wiesel Center for Jewish Studies hosting Luang Ung, A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers, November 18th. BU.edu/Jewish Studies.
This week, we met up at a diner in South Bend, Indiana, with the mayor, who's running for president. Pete Buttigieg criticizes the Medicare for All proposals.
The reality is all these beautiful proposals we all put forward, their impact is kind of multiplied by zero if you can't actually get it through Congress.
More of our conversation with Pete Buttigieg, plus all the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 8 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwahali Saikautau. As we've been reporting throughout the day, a new book called A Warning by an anonymous author identified only as a senior official in the Trump administration is making explosive claims. Among them, the author says, a group of senior officials inside the administration were prepared to resign en masse last year.
They decided that it would be too dangerous and risky for the country for these officials to leave because they were serving a value in thwarting the president's impulses that they needed to stay.
That's Philip Rucker, a Washington Post reporter, who received an early copy of the book titled A Warning by an Anonymous Author Who Describes Himself Only as a Senior Official in the Trump Administration. He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition earlier today. Ahead of Veterans Day this Monday, VA Secretary Robert Wilkie is praising the quality of VA health care. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the secretary spoke earlier at a White House briefing.
More veterans are satisfied with their VA health care than ever before, according to Veterans Affairs Secretary Robert Wilkie.
VA's health care is as good or better than any in the private sector, and our wait times are more than comparable with the private sector.
Wilkie praised President Trump for revamping legislation that allows veterans to have a choice of private care if they have to wait too long or live too far from a VA clinic. The president will attend the Veterans Day parade in New York City, just as he's been ordered by a New York state court to pay $2 million in damages for misusing money from a veterans charity fundraiser. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Taking a look at Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 6 points at 27,681. The NASDAQ is up 40 points to close at 8,475. And the S&P 500 is up 7 points. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Massachusetts hospitals perform better than the national average at ensuring patient safety, According to a report from the nonprofit Leapfrog Group, it finds 42% of hospitals in the state earned an A grade. That's compared to 33% nationwide. Facilities that have earned A's have low rates of medical errors, post-surgical infections, and patient falls. Among the hospitals to receive that grade are Mass General, Lahey Hospital, and Brigham and Women's Hospital. Amtrak is reporting record ridership growth on the Northeast Corridor. That growth was part of a record year nationwide for the fiscal year that ended in September. WBUR's Ninjor Enwemeka reports.
There are almost 9 million trips on the Northeast Regional train, about a 3% increase from the previous year. And Acela trips were also up, with over 3.5 million rides in fiscal year 2019. Amtrak President and CEO Richard Anderson says the company plans to expand service along the East Coast.
The long-term plan will be to run nonstop Acelas both ways in the peaks, in the morning and the evenings, between New York and Washington, Boston and New York.
Amtrak also reported a nearly $30 million operating loss, an improvement from previous years. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Zininjor Enwemeka.
This will be the last of 6 weekends of interrupted service on the Orange Line. The T says it will complete repairs and upgrades between Ruggles and Sullivan Square stations by Monday morning. Shuttle buses will be available from 8 o'clock tonight through the weekend to accommodate riders. It's 5:34.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by SBLI. Founded in 1907 by future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, SBLI is committed to providing families with straightforward life insurance. SBLI.com. And HomeTap, a new way to tap into your home's equity without interest or monthly payments. Learn how you can fund renovations, retirement, college tuition, and more at HomeTap.com.
Tonight, the Boston Bruins are in Detroit. The Bruins will be playing in Prague to kick off next year's hockey season. The NHL says the team will play the Nashville Predators in a regular season game after the teams finish up their training camps in Europe for the 2021 season. In the forecast, look for a clear night tonight, but pretty cold, down in the low 20s to the teens by morning. Tomorrow, sunny, inching toward 40, could top 50 on Sunday and Monday, Veterans Day, with partly sunny skies. 32 degrees now in Boston at 5:35.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Whole Foods Market, offering colors and flavors of the season with seasonal produce, holiday desserts, and chef-created menus. Whole Foods Market, color the classics. And TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We're going to go to Baghdad now, where anti-government demonstrations are intensifying. Protesters are asking for the overhaul of a political system plagued by corruption, poor government services, and a weak economy. The prime minister has been expected to resign for days, but he's resisting that pressure. Meanwhile, security forces have repeatedly opened fire on protesters and now even on medical workers. NPR's Jane Araf joins us now from Baghdad. Hey, Jane.
Hi, Elsa.
So can you just first describe what you've been seeing out there?
Yeah, so today was the Friday start of the weekend, and there were tens of thousands of people in the main square, Tahrir Square. There were protesters occupying that and an abandoned high-rise building overlooking the green zone. The real front line, though, is on the bridges that lead to that green zone where the U.S. Embassy and government offices are. So I was standing in front of a makeshift hospital near one of those bridges. Let's listen to a bit of what that sounded like. So in the space of just a few minutes, 6 ambulances pulled up. And I spoke to one of the medical volunteers who didn't want to give his name, but this is what he told me.
Now we know what they want. Yeah, they want to kill us to stay in the government. Stealing, to take everything from Iraq.
He said they want to kill us to stay in government, to steal everything from Iraq. Strong words, but that's what the protesters believe. And they are indeed being killed.
Yeah. Is the government explaining why they're resorting to violence? Had they responded in any other way to the protesters?
This is a really weird thing because security forces are actually saying they're not using lethal weapons. But we've spoken to medical staff at hospitals where some of the wounded have died. And they say these people were killed by live fire. Others have been killed by being hit by tear gas canisters. Today I met the father of a 13-year-old boy who was killed that way. And the prime minister, he has said he would resign, but now he seems to be digging in.
I know we can't predict where this is going to end up, but it does seem like the situation is deteriorating. Is that the sense you're getting out there?
It is. The more this goes on and the more deaths there are, the more the protesters are digging in, and it's becoming more and more grim. I sat with doctors and nurses who said they believed security forces were now deliberately targeting medical volunteers. And I also talked to some people who were Iraqi soldiers and militia fighters who have joined the protests. I sat in one room with these guys. They were sitting on mattresses on the floor. They didn't want to give their names, but here's what a couple had to say. Dying has become normal for us, is what he said. And another, who was a medic with the military on the front lines of the battle against ISIS, who had someone standing next to him killed last week, said, dying is an honor. And that's where we are. More killings, more arrests, disappearances. And the protesters are afraid, really afraid, but still more determined than ever to come out and face these security forces.
That is NPR's Jane Arraf in Baghdad. Thank you very much, Jane.
Thank you.
To Germany now, where the country is marking the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. NPR's Rob Schmitz has been documenting the changes that have taken place over those last three decades. And yesterday, he took us to the industrial engine of the former East, a city that is now facing challenges. Today, he takes us to a second city, one that is hoping to cash in on its medieval history.
When he was 22, Octavian Ursu watched the Berlin Wall fall on television from his home in Bucharest, Romania. As a college student, he had taken part in the bloody democratic uprising in Bucharest, and he cheered with those peacefully tearing down the wall, the symbol of a divided Europe. When he graduated a year later, he packed his bags for the new free Germany, where he found a job as the principal trumpet player for the Symphony Orchestra of Görlitz, a city in eastern Germany. When he arrived, he took a look around and wondered if he had made a mistake.
It was catastrophic. It looked like a city in ruins. It wasn't in good shape.
And it was about to get worse. As Ursu arrived, everyone else was leaving. Andrea Federica Baer was a teenager when her hometown lost half its population as tens of thousands left to find work in the West.
Everything was dark outside, all the buildings, you know, there was no paint on the wall. You thought, oh God, these buildings are going to break down.
Baer left too. She studied abroad in America. But while she was away, the German government provided reconstruction funds for Görlitz. So when she returned as an adult, her hometown looked very different.
Wenn Sie heute oder Sie sehen mich bei dieser Frage mit einem Lächeln im Auge.
When you walk through the city today, you see the beauty, thousands of monuments from different parts of history all lined up next to each other.
Görlitz dates back to the Middle Ages when it was a trading center along the Via Regia, an ancient road dating back to the Holy Roman Empire. Görlitz survived the widespread destruction of World War II, leaving the city's centuries-old cathedrals and narrow cobblestone streets intact. Baer and others from her hometown saw potential. They marketed the city's unblemished European feel to Hollywood. Görlitz is the backdrop to director Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel. Quentin Tarantino came to the city to shoot part of Inglourious Basterds, and parts of the 2013 Oscar-nominated The Reader were shot here, too. The city was even nicknamed Girlywood. Baer is now in charge of encouraging people to move to the city.
Many people like me want to come back to raise their children and take care of their grandparents. The quality of life here is high.
The city's trying to recruit young, skilled workers to live in Görlitz by offering applicants a free apartment for a month if they try the city out. All of this is great if you have a job. Unemployment in Görlitz is above 10%.
My aim is to get more inhabitants and young people to Görlitz again. But for that, we also need well-paid jobs in future technologies.
Remember Octavian Ursu, the Romanian trumpet player who arrived at Görlitz right after the wall fell? He's just been elected mayor, and he's got big dreams for his adopted hometown. He's courting startup companies, and he wants to tap EU funds to build train connections to Prague and Berlin. When I ask him when he plans to do all of this, he tells me yesterday.
Look, my becoming mayor has happened in a place where people said it couldn't happen, but it has.
Saxony, the state where Görlitz is located, is infamous for being unfriendly to migrants. And yet, here's Ursu, the first migrant mayor in the history of Saxony. Cities in the former East can change, Ursu says, and he insists Görlitz is changing for the better. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Görlitz, Germany.
And starting tomorrow, NPR is putting out a Saturday morning edition of Up First, our morning news podcast. Get the three biggest news stories first thing Saturday. Look for Up First wherever you find your podcasts.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Chile and Argentina are the giants of South American wine. Neighboring Bolivia is better known for snow-capped mountains than sun-drenched vineyards. But Bolivia is starting to attract the notice of wine connoisseurs. Reporter John Otis has more.
Gerardo Aguirre takes a half dozen wine aficionados on a tour of the Aranjuez Winery. It was founded by Aguirre's grandfather in 1976 here in Tarija, a city located near Bolivia's southern border with Argentina.
Más floral, no sé si han sentido flor de naranjo, jazmín.
Aguirre describes the lavender and jasmine aromas in the company's signature white wine. Then his guests try it for themselves. The visitors seem impressed, with some comparing it to fine French wine. They're not alone. In recent years, Bolivian wines have won rave reviews from wine critics and prestigious international awards. Now, Aranjuez and other wineries here are starting to export.
They want Bolivian wine in Chile. How's that? Yeah, because Bolivian wine is exotic. We're high-altitude wine. We're getting good wine. Here in Aranjuez, we're getting a lot of medals in really serious contests.
Winemaking was introduced to South America by Spanish settlers in the 1600s. The industry took hold in Argentina and Chile, which are home to temperate climates and flatlands perfect for vineyards. Bolivia, by contrast, is closer to the equator and is dominated by Amazon jungle and the Andes Mountains. That leaves little space to grow grapes. In places where they have been planted, like on this farm near Tarija, where workers are watering grape seedlings, the land is more than a mile high. That's why Gonzalo Pinedo, part owner of the farm, prefers a grape variety known as Tanat. Tanat grapes have thicker skins to resist the intense sunlight of high altitudes and have become a favorite of Bolivian winemakers. Pinedo says Tanat grapes produce intense and bold red wines that have impressed sommeliers. I think wine drinkers are looking for new things, he says, and the difference here is the high altitude. The growing prominence of Bolivia's wine industry brings thousands of visitors to Tarija every year. This bus plays Bolivian folk music as it ferries tourists from one winery to the next. They're a jolly bunch, in part because rather than using spit buckets at the tastings, they simply swallow the wine. Bolivian wine is still hard to find in the U.S. and other countries. Nearly all of these bottles at the Aranjuez warehouse are being shipped to retailers inside Bolivia, where the economy and wine consumption are expanding. Winemakers are scrambling to produce more for export, but are limited by the lack of suitable land. Still, Aguirre points out that it wasn't so long ago that Bolivian wine was unheard of beyond the country's borders.
We looked at like a dream. I mean, like, when it would be the day that we have quality wine like they do in Argentina? It was like a utopic dream. But now we're making good wine, man. You know, after these many years, we are in the same quality of Argentina and Chile, and that's only because of the grapes, a lot of learning in the process, and of course, a lot of work.
For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Tarija, Bolivia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Handel and Haydn Society, Mozart's exhilarating Jupiter Symphony, and music of Beethoven and C.P.E. Bach, today and Sunday at Symphony Hall, handelandhaydn.org. Innuendo, covering Metro Boston windows for 30 years with shades, blinds, draperies, and more. Innuendo's design team in Natick and innuendo.com. And Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, a global leader in ocean science, technology, and education. Visit whoi.edu/WBUR.
In the forecast, clear, dry, and cold overnight tonight, dropping to the upper teens to low to mid-20s. Temperature should fall to, or it should rise to about the 30s tomorrow. Look for sunshine through the day and then for Sunday and Monday as well. Temperatures about 50 degrees with partly sunny skies. Turn your old car into new news. Support the programming you love by donating your vehicle to WBUR. We get great value. You get a tax deduction. Details at WBUR.org/cars.
WBUR supporters include Sunovion with a vision for a healthier world. Advance through innovation that helps people living with serious medical conditions. Take on tomorrow. More at Sunovion.com. And Patriot Place. The MBTA commuter rail offers weekday service from Foxborough to Boston, morning, midday, and evening trains. Visit MBTA.com/Foxborough.
With so much happening at home and abroad, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. At WBUR, we don't endlessly chase the next headline. We follow the story and report it with context. We talk to experts and moderate thoughtful discussions we believe are worth having with a lens on Boston and the region. Boston's NPR news station, WBUR. Get it.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The musician FKA Twigs wants you to know that it is okay to be not okay. Her breathy soprano and Baroque pop arrangements impressed critics when her debut album came out in 2014. Since then, Twigs has been through a lot.
Didn't I do it for you? Why don't I do it for you?
Her relationship with an A-list actor ended with lots of tabloid coverage. And the classically trained dancer had a health scare. She had surgery to remove tumors from her uterus. It is that pain that feeds the drama of FKA Twigs' sophomore album, Magdalene, as she recently told my co-host, Audie Cornish.
The truth is, I'm so grateful to have gone through such intense pain and confusion emotionally and physically. It's been beautiful, and during that time I've really deciphered who I am and what I want. I think the biggest thing I've learned on this album is truly how to write for my voice. I feel like I sort of found a key and stepped out of my soprano golden birdcage.
I just want to feel your love. And
this is very much out of the soprano golden cage, I think.
Yeah.
Do you mind me asking about your process?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I always feel a bit sort of strange, I guess, talking about my process, because truly each time is completely different. I went on the mic and pretty much sang the whole thing in one take almost, and the vocal that's there is the vocal that I did in the hour.
Do it for you. Why don't I do it?
That's incredible.
Yeah, I think on this album, nothing really felt unpleasurably labored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just trying so hard to, like, fix something. You keep on fixing it and breaking it and fixing it and breaking it until you don't really know where you are with the music. Mm-hmm. But luckily on this album, that didn't really happen.
Every time you look outside your window, everything is just the same as before. You are turning round and round, you see it's a sad day for sure.
Your visual style has always been very dramatic. You've always had an incredible sense of style that's kind of reflective of punk and other influences. And I was reading that growing up you were obsessed with ballet and operas.
Well, I started studying classical ballet when I was 7 or 8 years old, and I think that really sort of turned me on to classical music.
I wondered how it informed your songwriting, because your songs, especially on this album, are very vulnerable and almost have a kind of tragic heroine feel. Like, I could easily feel the influence of someone who, you know, has listened to a lot of fallen heroines, and opera made sense when I heard it.
Mm. It's interesting that you say fallen heroines, because for me it's like the strongest I've ever sounded. You
really?
Know, I feel, yeah, I mean, to me, when I listen to the record, I really feel it all sort of came together and like it's going to be okay. But that's it, the interesting thing about making music, because I guess it's not mine anymore.
Right, everyone, you know, takes something from it. Right.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing. It just depends what place, like, the listener's in and what they want to take.
I think I want to focus also more specifically maybe on the issue of physical pain, because you are a dancer. Your performance and visuals are very physical. And I know that when I went through a physical ailment, it really made me reckon with myself and my body. I felt betrayed by my body for a long time.
Right.
And so I, given that this is called Magdalene, I guess I wanted to explore that even more than the heartbreak side.
A woman's work.
Yeah.
Here's the song, Mary Magdalene.
A woman's prerogative. A woman's time to embrace. She must put herself first.
So the opening of this song is the idea, a woman's prerogative, a woman's time to embrace, she must put herself first. I feel like that's a lesson you learn when you go through something physical in particular.
I mean, I think for me, it relates to the unpaid and unacknowledged emotional labor that women put into the world on a daily basis. Certainly ever since I was young, I was taught to nurture and taught to be aware of myself socially and aware of my emotions and mother.
I can lift you higher, I do it like Mary Magdalene. All you desire, come just a little bit closer till we collide.
Connecting with Mary Magdalene over the past couple of years spiritually, I started to explore the concept of the virgin whore, which is the idea that as a woman you can be pure and you can be innocent and you can be like a fresh flower, but at the same time you can be dangerous and seductive and all-knowing and healing. Then it's been incredibly exciting for me to know that that's okay and it exists, and I am as much sacred as I am sensual.
And that there's nothing wrong with either.
Yeah, that's the whole point. You don't have to choose. But I am both, and that is stunning.
Yes, I heard you needed me. Yes, I'm here to open you. Yes, I know that your heart is blue.
I was reading in a statement where you said, throughout my life, I've practiced my way to being the best I could be. It didn't work this time. I had to tear down every process I've ever relied on, go deeper, rebuild, and start again.
Mm.
Where are you now in that process?
Yeah, for the album, I really had to like let that concept go. But right now, as we talk, I'm sitting here in my like wushu training gear with my sword at my feet.
I forgot. Yes, you are practicing. It's a martial art, correct? Or sword fighting?
Exactly. Right now I'm completely I'm back into practice mode, which is my safe place. But I do acknowledge that sometimes that isn't enough. And there is a realm beyond practice, which you can't control. And that's what I learned in making Magdalene. And it was a really great lesson.
Well, FKA Twigs, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. But I'm never gonna go.
FKA Twigs' latest album is called Magdalene. It's out now.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Starz, presenting the original series Dublin Murders, based on the novels In the Woods and The Likeness by Tana French. Dublin Murders premieres November 10th at 8 p.m. on Starz. Home Advisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can read reviews, book appointments, and check cost guides for home projects at homeadvisor.com or on the mobile app. And C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
In the forecast, continued cold this evening and overnight tonight, dropping to the low 20s or even the teens by tomorrow morning, with a hard freeze in the early hours tomorrow. Sunny, breezy, and chilly for the day, not quite as cold, right about 40. Sunday and the holiday on Monday, sunshine mixed with clouds, a little bit milder, with temperatures in the low 50s tops. 32 degrees in Boston at 1 before 6.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. House Democrats on Capitol Hill today released transcripts of interviews from two national security officials that prompted more backlash from the president. What the transcripts reveal, coming up this half hour. It's Friday, November 8th, and this is WBUR's All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead, the invasive Asian carp continues to populate, impervious to efforts to curb the fish. Now researchers are trying a new way to halt the spread of the species using an acoustic fence. 30 years ago, the Berlin Wall came down. Coming up, new dividing lines that have emerged. And on Marketplace, starting at 6:30, why some East German business owners feel like they're still at a disadvantage to the West.
Well, I'm deeply disappointed that they were not able to give the East a chance to reconstruct.
Germany's economic wall, coming up on Marketplace. It's 6:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. House Republicans are adding a top Trump ally on Capitol Hill to the Intelligence Committee to help fight the impeachment inquiry. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio will be a key figure for Republicans in new open hearings.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy selected Jordan to join the intelligence panel to battle a, quote, sham process. The move comes days before Democrats are set to launch a series of open hearings in a new public phase of the impeachment inquiry. House investigators are examining claims President Trump pressured the Ukrainian president for a probe of his political opponent in exchange for U.S. military aid. McCarthy said another Republican member of the Intelligence Committee, Rick Crawford of Arkansas, would step down for his seat for Jordan. Jordan is a top public supporter of Trump and has led GOP questioning and closed-door impeachment hearings. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Washington.
Brazil's former president, Lula da Silva, is out of jail. Last year, he was sentenced to nearly 9 years in prison after being convicted of corruption and money laundering. And NPR's Philip Reeves reports a judge ordered his release after a landmark court ruling.
Fireworks echoed across Brazil's southern city of Curitiba as Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva emerged from the lockup where he spent the last 580 days. The 74-year-old two-term president dived into the waiting crowd, who greeted him with hugs, songs and flowers. He made an emotional speech thanking his supporters. The release of Lula, as he's known, follows a court ruling saying convicted defendants can remain at liberty until all appeals are exhausted. He faces more corruption allegations. Yet for now, his return to the political battlefield is being celebrated by the left across Latin America as a major victory and a big setback for his opponent, Brazil's far-right President Jair Bolsonaro. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
President Trump says he has not agreed to remove any of the tariffs that he has placed on Chinese imports a day after a Chinese official said both countries had agreed to a phased cancellation of their tariff hikes as part of an emerging agreement. This as the world's two biggest economies struggle to end their trade war, and China's trade surplus with the U.S. widened last month. NPR's Emily Fang reports the imbalance grew despite the trade war.
China's October exports dropped less than expected as American demand for Chinese goods strengthened slightly and brings some relief for a slowing Chinese economy. Yet because China's imports drop more than exports, that means China still sells more to the U.S. than it buys. China's declining trade numbers have been exacerbated by a trade war with the U.S., but stem more from structural problems with its own economy.
NPR's Emily Fang. Wall Street higher by the closing bell. The Dow up 6 points. The Nasdaq up 40 points. The S&P 500 up 7 points to close in record territory of 3093. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Investigators believe a chemical reaction led to the death of a restaurant general manager in Burlington. The victim has been identified today as Ryan Baldera of Lawrence. Fire officials say the reaction started when another employee mixed two cleaning products together to clean the floor inside Buffalo Wild Wings. Investigators say the general manager was trying to get the cleaning materials out of the building when he was overcome by fumes. Joe Biden is the latest Democrat running for president to file for the New Hampshire primary. As WBUR's Anthony Brooks reports, the former vice president turned in papers this afternoon in Concord.
Biden walked through a crowd of rowdy supporters who lined the corridors of the New Hampshire State House as he headed to the Secretary of State's office to file for the first in the nation primary. Afterward, he braved a winter-like chill outside where he told supporters that he'll beat President Trump like a drum. He also took a jab at his progressive opponents, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who are pushing for Medicare for all.
Folks I'm running against or with are saying, well, you can no longer have your private insurance. Let them make up their own mind. If they don't want their private insurance, if they don't like what they have, they can join the public option that I provide in Obamacare and expand it.
For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Concord, New Hampshire.
A verdict will be delivered Tuesday in the case of a Webster man charged with manslaughter in the death of a state trooper. David Jugunia is accused of driving while high on marijuana and crashing into Trooper Thomas Clardy's cruiser 3 years ago. The defendant claims the crash on the Mass Turnpike in Charlton was the result of a medical event. And the Census Bureau plans to raise wages for census workers in parts of central and western Mass. It's an effort to boost lagging recruitment, especially in rural areas. The temporary workers are needed to survey households next year for the population count. The Bureau says it will raise pay by up to $1.50 an hour in Worcester, Hampden, Franklin, Hampshire, and Berkshire counties. The current pay range in those areas is $14.50 to $18 an hour. Boston Bruins are on the road. They're in Detroit to take on the Red Wings tonight. And in the forecast, clear and pretty cold overnight tonight, down in the low 20s, even the teens by tomorrow morning. And for tomorrow, sunny, inching toward 40, could top 50 on Sunday and Monday, Veterans Day, with partly sunny skies. Holding steady at 32 degrees now in Boston at 6 past 6.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by AE Events, design and production of corporate and nonprofit events, weddings, and conferences. New website at aeevents.com, where style meets substance. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to ensure that families and communities have opportunities to create a brighter future for America's youth. More information is available at aecf.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. This week has seen hundreds of pages of transcripts released in the ongoing impeachment inquiry into President Trump. And today, you can add 806 new pages to that total. They spell out the testimonies of former White House Russia advisor Fiona Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council. And these pages show how the ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, acted to press the Ukrainian government to open investigations into the Bidens. And they show that Sondland said that there would be no meeting between the White House and Ukraine until that happened. NPR reporter Tim Mack has been following all of this, and he joins us now. Hey, Tim.
Hey there.
All right, so let's start with Fiona Hill. She's the former Russia policy expert on the National Security Council. What did she tell House investigators?
So Hill tells a story about a meeting between the Ukrainian officials and White House officials in D.C. prior to that now famous July 25th phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. At the time, Ukrainian officials are trying to arrange a meeting between President Zelensky and President Trump. Now, National Security Advisor John Bolton is pushing that off, won't agree, wants to discuss further the possibility of a meeting, but Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland blurts out that there's already a deal between the White House Chief of Staff and him, and says that they will have a meeting with the president if the Ukrainian government launches investigations into their energy sector. So this shows how Gordon Sondland was running an unofficial rogue diplomatic channel with the White House Chief of Staff's seeming consent.
Okay, let's turn now to the testimony from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He's the current director for European Affairs at the National Security Council. What did we learn from his transcript?
Well, Vindman is an active duty military officer. He's a professional. He knows how this process, these conversations between world leaders, normally go. And something struck him about this July 25th phone call between the president and the president of Ukraine. He was on the call, and afterwards, he couldn't make the edits to the rough transcript that are kind of part of his job, and it really suggested to him how sensitive this issue was to people in the White House. Vindman also felt that something wrong had occurred on the call, and it speaks to the heart of whether there was an effort to press Ukrainians for an investigation. So here I am reading from the transcript. Congressman Peter Welch says, "And was there any doubt in your mind as to what the president, our president, was asking for as a deliverable?" And Vindman replies, "There was no doubt." Later, Vindman is pressed by Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe, who asked how we know that there was a demand by the president, since the rough transcript of the call doesn't include that word. Vindman explains that there are power disparities between these two presidents, and that those power disparities are so vast that it was quite obvious it was a demand, that in order to get a White House meeting, the Ukrainians had to start up investigations.
Okay, so further buttressing the Democrats' case that there was a quid pro quo. Also within these pages and pages, I understand that we saw references about acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. How did Hill and Vindman describe Mulvaney's role in all of this?
Well, Fiona Hill testified about how John Bolton was disturbed about the pressing of the Ukrainian officials for investigations and Mulvaney's apparent role in it. Vindman also says that Mulvaney's office was behind the hold in military aid. He says that he was told in July that the hold on military aid was coming from the White House Chief of Staff's office.
Okay, so speaking of Mick Mulvaney, he was subpoenaed but did not show up, correct?
Right. He was supposed to show up today, and he didn't, but we have heard from him. You'll recall the press conference he gave where he essentially said, look, there was a quid pro quo. This is the way the game is played. Get over it. But later he reversed himself and tried to walk it back. These transcripts show he had a central role in this whole saga, that he was involved in both the withholding of the aid and the conditions conveyed to the Ukrainians in order for them to achieve their goal of a meeting with President Trump.
That's NPR's Tim Mack. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Time now to talk about the week in politics. Today, I'm joined by Margaret Hoover of PBS's Firing Line. Hi there, Margaret.
Hi.
Hi. And E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Georgetown's McCourt School. E.J., welcome back.
Great to be with you.
All right. Top line reaction from each of you to all those transcripts we have just been hearing about from Tim Mack, the hundreds and hundreds of pages that seem to emerge every day. Any of them a game changer? What's the takeaway? E.J., you first.
I think it's moving the game in the direction it was already moving, which is more and more and more evidence that there was a quid pro quo. I was also, by the way, struck, and I should say Fiona Hill was my colleague at the Brookings Institution. I was also struck by her discussion of the threat she felt she was under and others were. And she also talked about the very damaging role played by some of this misinformation in our efforts to fight future Russian interference in the election. I think the Republicans are now going to be reduced to trying to throw Mick Mulvaney, Rudy Giuliani, and many others under the bus. They seem to be trying to create some ignorance defense of President Trump, that this all went on and he had nothing to do with it. They've still got to deal with that White House document in which he asked for a favor. So I think they are just being pushed back and back in their defense. I think they're finally going to say, okay, he did it, but we shouldn't impeach him. That's where this seems to be going.
All right. So your take would be this has been a very good week for Democrats. Margaret, what do you think?
This week has been a good week for getting to the truth. The release of the transcripts has been enormously detailed, and it says three things just top line. One, there is no doubt that there was a quid pro quo. That the doubt or the question about whether that existed has been effectively erased because
even
of the
Gordon
release of these
Sondland has said, "I now remember. My memory's been refreshed. Not only was there a quid pro quo, but I delivered it."
The other two things that are important to remember is that what we have seen is little leaks, dribs and drabs of the public hearing what was happening in these hearings. But now, with the transcripts of these testimonies, what you have are two things additionally: the veracity of the information we were getting through leaks. Is verified and more. There's enormous amount of texture in the transcripts that verifies that the information was true and that the character of the individuals who are testifying is unflawed. From Fiona Hill to Alex Vindman to Kent, you have a propensity of data. You have an enormous amount of data now and testimony under oath that demonstrates that these people are people of upstanding character and true civil servants who are not adhering to any political agenda. They are simply serving their country.
And could I underscore just one? That's a really important point, and I think that will be very telling when these hearings go public, because I think people have a good sense of that when they watch someone like Fiona Hill or like Vindman or who really, as Margaret said, really are civil servants.
Now, about public opinion, though, I will say this. I don't believe that any of the information is going to dramatically sway that has been released over the weekend. I don't think Americans are going to go home and read 1,300 pages of transcripts, but it will play into what we see next week, because the theater and the performance and what Americans see next week on television as these public testimonies begin is when you're really going to begin to see what we, those of us who are reading the transcripts, see right now.
A whole three-ring circus unfolding on Capitol Hill next week. Meanwhile, the rest of the world keeps spinning, and among the things spinning, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, now says he might be jumping back into the Democratic field. He says he doesn't see anybody who can beat Trump right now, so he's weighing this again. Reaction from each of you, good idea, bad idea? Margaret.
Well, if you believe that the country's politics have become so polarized, there is a hyper-partisanship that it pervades the processes of nominating a candidate, and you represent or you believe that a candidate who represents either the center-left or the center-right is going to represent the majority of Americans, you should be happy that Mike Bloomberg is considering running. Mike Bloomberg is a moderate Democrat. He's not a progressive Democrat in the mold of Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, and he knows that. And he's concerned that there is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party that the Democratic Party is going to lose. His side's going to lose. And what's very interesting is he's always been a data guy. The data has not changed. The data does not favor Mike Bloomberg winning a progressive primary. But he seems to be moving the direction of getting in anyway, which is a curious turn of events.
It certainly shakes things up. EJ, is there even a path to the nomination for somebody jumping in so late?
I don't see a path for him. Let's just say first, Mike Bloomberg was a good mayor in New York City. He's a moderate who in many, many ways was a progressive mayor. And no one
used to be a moderate Republican. I mean,
right. Well, he was very.
The path.
He took the Republican line on the ballot so he could become mayor. He's never really been a Republican, but he was one nominally. And no one, by the way, has done more to finance the gun control movement. He's made a huge difference that way. But it is very hard to see how he wins. He has really made Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders very happy because they have a billionaire foil now that they can play against. And he seems to be giving a vote of no confidence in Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, the people closest to him. Biden has certainly disappointed some of his backers. Buttigieg is actually gaining ground in Iowa, and Biden is still ahead, by the way, in South Carolina and Nevada. You could have a situation where Bloomberg hurts the two candidates closest to him without winning himself, and I can't see why he would want to do that.
Fascinating. Very quickly, in the minute we have left, I can't let y'all go without asking about Anonymous, the author of a new book that is dropping in a few days. Your newspaper, The Washington Post, EJ, got its hands on a copy. Have you seen a copy?
I have not seen a copy.
What's your take?
Well, there are some fascinating observations in here. I loved the one about Trump seeming like an air traffic controller punching randomly at buttons.
A 12-year-old.
Traffic controller. I'd feel better if Anonymous were public. I think that at this point, this person, he or she, should just come out, leave the administration and say it. And she or he confirmed almost all our worst fears about Trump.
Margaret, we just have a second left. Do you agree Anonymous should become public?
Here, EJ. I don't know if you and I have ever agreed on so much at once. But absolutely. Look, these civil servants who are serving our country or testifying before Congress are putting their names on the line. Anonymous should, too.
All right. That is Margaret Hoover of PBS's Firing Line and EJ Dionne of The Washington Post and Georgetown's McCourt School. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
And
this is NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gourmet Caterers, more than 45 years providing catering for lavish galas, corporate events, weddings, and home entertaining. GourmetCaterers.com, always gourmet.
The Dow ended the week up just a small fraction today, about 6 points, to finish at 27,681. S&P almost hit another record high close. It rose about 0.25% to end the day at 3093. And the Nasdaq picked up about 0.5% to finish at 8475. Details in about 10 minutes on Marketplace. It's 19 past 6.
Funding for WBUR's Business Report comes from Vertex, a proud contributor of Massachusetts' innovation ecosystem. Fueled by the needs of patients, families, doctors, and nurses, Vertex invests in science to develop new medicines and strike at the core of serious diseases. Learn more at VRTX.com.
The holiday weekend forecast now with meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Lots of clear skies for the rest of the evening. Temperatures hold in the 30s with that gusty wind. And late tonight, we're down in the upper teens to mid-20s. Tomorrow, Saturday, sunshine. It's a cold start. We're only near 40 in the afternoon, less wind. Sunday, partly sunny, lower 50s, breezy. Veterans Day, Monday, partly sunny, low 50s. Some rain around the area for Tuesday and colder.
Stay with WBUR and NPR next Wednesday and Friday for a complete live coverage and analysis of the first public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Once again, that's next Wednesday and Friday on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
WBUR supporters include Boston University, Wheelock College of Education and Human Development's graduate programs in counseling psychology, applied human development, and child life and family-centered care. bu.edu/Wheelock.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 30 years ago tomorrow, the Berlin Wall came down, reuniting East and West Germany. And today, there are new dividing lines. Germany took in nearly 1 million refugees in 2015 alone, most of them from the Middle East and North Africa. Anti-immigrant groups have grown, speaking of a new us and them. A far-right party has become the biggest political opposition group in the country. And today, we're going to check in with one Syrian refugee living in Berlin. Our co-host Ari Shapiro first met him 4 years ago on the coast of Turkey.
His name is Ahmad Akkad, but when I met him, he asked me not to use his last name because he hadn't told his family that he was planning to board a crowded raft in Turkey to risk his life crossing the Mediterranean Sea.
Tell me, what's the option? Go back to Syria? Okay, we're gonna die. Stay here, we're gonna die. So this is the only option we have.
He eventually boarded that rubber boat bound for Greece, and once he arrived safely on land, he told us about the journey.
We tried two times. The first time the boat sinked because it was full of people, like 55. We swim back to the beach. So we tried another time. Second time, it was okay. We reached Greece safely. No one gets hurt.
From Greece, he traveled to Hungary and eventually reached his destination, Germany. He enrolled in a graduate program and started volunteering, helping other recent arrivals from Syria.
I'm living with a family in Fürstenberg. I'm looking for the apartment.
That was back in 2015. Now Akkad is 29 years old, and he jokes that his German has gotten better while his English has gotten worse. Ahmad, welcome back to the program. I'm so happy to talk to you again.
Hi, thank you for the nice introduction that like got me like 4 years back or maybe.
Yeah, what's it like to hear your own voice describing that journey you made in 2015?
Oh, that got me like really old memories. Like, I don't know, just like I got like views in my head like that time, like traveling like in Turkey, Greece, like all the journey.
Well, tell us about your life today.
I already started with my master's and like going to finish it hopefully this year. I'm working since beginning of 2018 in an engineering company. Like I'm working in power plants. Like I can
You're working
think
on power
like how
plants
the buildings
as an engineer?
Yes, as a civil engineer. I'm living here for 4 years till now, so I feel myself home.
Berlin is this cosmopolitan international city, but across Germany, especially in the former Eastern Germany, there has been a real growth of anti-immigrant sentiment, hate crimes, hostility towards refugees, including Syrians. Is that something that you see?
I went through some situations like that. They are not getting like the full image. We need to clear it for them. We need to help them to go through that by telling them more about ourselves. Like, they don't know us. So I think for sure we're going to be a danger. Like, for humans, what they don't know, they are afraid of.
Can you tell us an experience that you had?
I was in a shop. It was like a coffee shop. I needed, like, to do some paperwork. There was a guy, from his look, he didn't like me, like the way I look maybe, you know, like the Middle Eastern way, like I look. So I went out when I done, he followed me and he told me like, go back to your country, go fight there and stuff like that.
How did you respond?
My response, I was like telling him about the situation, like, sorry, do you know like what's going on in Syria? Do you know like what's going to happen if I go back? Hopefully he checked the situation after that and he knows more now what's going on the other half of the war.
You know, Germany is having this debate right now over what makes a person German. How do you answer that question, given that your life is surrounded by people from all over the world in Berlin?
First, I would say it's not going to be a paper. It's not like a piece of paper going to say like, I'm German or I am like from that part of the world. It's not a piece of paper. It's going to be like how you're working for the people who's living here, how you are active in the people around you.
When the Berlin Wall fell, you were not yet born. Your family was living in Syria. And so what does tomorrow's anniversary mean for you? Will you be celebrating it? Does it have an important symbolism to you?
Yes, for sure. That's something I'm going to celebrate. And I hope like in the future, all walls going to fall down, like not even in the one country, but between all the countries. We made the walls ourselves. It's not like material walls. It's not like the cement. We have like more walls. And I hope these walls will fall down and I will try like my best to help in that. We are humans. We are one nation. That's like what I believe in, and that's what I'll try to help to reach.
Ahmad Akkad, it is great talking with you again. Thank you. I'm glad to hear your life is going so well.
Thank you. Thank you, too.
That's Ahmad Akkad, a Syrian refugee now living in Germany, talking with our co-host, Ari Shapiro.
State and federal officials flipped the switch on a $7 million underwater boombox today at a dam in Kentucky. The bioacoustic fish fence is just the latest effort to try to halt the invasive Asian carp. From member station WPLN, Jason Moon Wilkins reports.
Barkley Dam in rural western Kentucky is considered a pinch point for controlling the spread of Asian carp. And with lots of dead fish floating around, it's also kind of a pinch-your-nose point.
Smells great, don't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Carp are already jumping. It might be a good day to see them jump.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Wow.
Looking down, you can see a few fish popping out of the calm, flat lake, but a split second later, that's hundreds and hundreds of carp flying into the air like a big boiling pot around a small electrofishing boat. It's one of the methods used to contain an invasive species brought to the U.S. decades ago to help clean fish ponds and sewage systems. Since then, they've dealt millions in damage to economies and ecosystems. For southern states, the most concerning of the four Asian carp species is silverhead, the leaping kind, famous in viral videos for smacking boaters in the face. They don't like loud noises, and British engineer David Lambert is using that against them by blasting carp with a...
a bubble curtain. Simple as that.
A bubble curtain doesn't sound intimidating, but each tiny bubble contains noises up to 160 decibels, like the inside of a jet engine, but tuned especially for carp. A U.S. fish biologist calls it a disco barrier, because it also uses lights shooting through the bubbles to scare away fish. Now, Lambert wouldn't describe the sound it makes.
Well, that's the proprietary nature of it, so I'm not going to actually imitate it now.
It's terrifying.
That's journalist Andrew Reeves, who wrote a book on Asian carp. Officials in Canada played him the noise they're using, which he describes as
an outboard motor that is constantly being revved again and again and again.
This system has worked well in other settings, but this will be the biggest field test ever deployed for carp. Reeves says experts are excited, but they've redefined success.
They really don't talk much about eradication simply because they know that at this stage in the game, it's impossible. Asian carp will be a presence in American waterways forever.
If the disco barrier works in Kentucky, officials plan to ask for more funding for other areas as early as next year. For NPR News, I'm Jason Moon Wilkins.
It's NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. Continued cold this evening and overnight tonight, dropping to the low 20s or even the teens by tomorrow morning. A hard freeze early tomorrow. Then it should turn sunny, breezy, still chilly, but not quite as cold, right about 40 degrees. For Sunday and the holiday on Monday, Veterans Day, sunshine mixed with some clouds, a little bit milder, could reach the low 50s tops. 32 degrees now in Boston at 6:30.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Cambridge School of Culinary Arts, hosting private events for team building, family get-togethers, and everything in between. More information at cambridgeculinary.com. Greeno Brand Storytellers, health, technology, science, and business stories since 1999. greenough.biz/welltold. And Patriot Place. The MBTA offers weekday commuter rail service from Foxborough to Boston, on-site parking available. Information at mbta.com/Foxborough.